Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
That's what I'm talking about. That's how it was done back in 1988. Judas Priest, or in your language, Judas Priest, live from New Haven, Connecticut, was recorded by Westwood One Mobile, Vic Dawes Engineer, assisted by Doug Field and Mike Carver, in studio production by Stephen Cosio. We'd like to give props to Rob Halford for stopping by. This special Grammy edition of High Voltage is a presentation of Westwood One. Don't you dare miss music's biggest night, the 51st Annual Grammy Awards, coming Sunday, February 8th. 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time on CBS. This program is the albatross around the neck of Fred Lindgren. Executive pimp is Norm. Don't call me Charles Barkley Pattis. I'm Nick Carter, and as usual, peace out, bitches!
101.1 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Jalene Jordan off for the evening. I don't know if I should say this, but man, she's sick. Whew. Got the flu. Sounded terrible. Jalene, if you're listening, I love you. Get better quickly, okay? It's just not the same. One thing, she keeps kind of my anger down. I know I don't express it a lot, but everything that's happening sure has got me in a mood. Even though, wow, what a game. I'm usually not too much into football. It's not my favorite sport by any regard. But the Steelers beating the Cardinals in the last 35 seconds. Looked like the Cards were going to pull it out. And then, wow, brilliant six-yard catch deep in the right corner of the end zone by Santonio Holmes. And Steelers now with a record-setting sixth Super Bowl win, 27-23 over the Arizona Cardinals. Let's make that the end of our conversation about the Super Bowl, okay? Because what we're supposed to be talking about is what's happening in our lives when we're not enjoying ourselves. And I've been enjoying myself the last few nights. So, you know, someone once said to me that you must be the grimmest guy in the world. You know, all you talk about is what's wrong and what's bad and how everything's going to hell in a handbasket. And I go, well, I suppose I do sound a lot like that on the air. But, you know, we have to have different sides to us. And so there is a side where I go out, like last night, which was the last night of the Ferndale Blues Festival, which had some incredible music all around the Nine Mile and Woodward area. Great local bands, rocking the blues. And then on the other hand, we have to look seriously at our lives because we are in some deep stuff, folks. I don't think I have to tell anybody that. And it's like every day. I mean, even a couple of weeks ago, I was saying to people, you know, this doesn't seem real, this recession slash depression. I don't hardly know anybody where anything bad has happened to. No one I know has lost their. It's like this avalanche suddenly, right? And that's what's happening. I mean, the system bleeding. Bleeding jobs. Oh, I should tell you, by the way, this is a phone-in talk show. I always forget. I mean, there's so many of us have been together on this Night Call adventure for so long that a lot of times there's people listening for the first time. I'm always amazed somehow, I don't know why, that they say, well, I heard your program for the first time. Anyways, this is a phone-in talk show for the first 2 hours, and it usually stars me, Peter Werby. Stars, wow, I never said that before. Features or the host, whatever, me, Peter Werby, and also my co-host, Jalene Jordan, who is out ill tonight. She's tough, though. She'll be back. And if you want to call in, 313-298-WRIF. Usually talk shows, they like pose a subject and then you respond. I make some provocative statement, which I tend to do. But you're probably as ADD as I am. So just when the mood hits you to comment on something or to bring up something new, please do so. in numerals, and I usually count on Jolene for this. The phone number is 313-298-9743. For the bashful, and when the phones are filled, you can reach us. Oh, it's just me tonight, isn't it? At calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That's the first 2 hours. At 1 a.m. Eastern Time, and I say Eastern Time because there's people listening all over the country and all over the world. Had a little trouble with our stream last week because we were switching servers. And remember, you can always get the podcast. You can always get the podcast. Go to WRIF.com or my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And you can hit the podcast by noon Monday. It'll be up there. There's also a MySpace page and a Facebook, which I have no idea what's going on with those, but Jolene takes care of those. So that's it. And Roger will be answering our phones. Thank you, Roger. And let's see. Oh, yeah, I got to go to the screen here and look and see what people want to talk about. But let me talk about the economy a little bit. And what are we? I don't even, you know, so far we're not doing anything. We're still in the hope arena, right? We're hoping that the big guys take care of it. The bad big guys got blown out. The bad big guys made this mess. And it's the little ones, that's us, who are suffering because they made all the mistakes. We're paying all the penalties. Few of them are. I mean, but not entirely. In fact, we'll get to our Eat the Rich segment in a little while. Well, here's what's going on, and this is typical for depression, particularly for depression, where I barely understand economics, and I was thinking, you know, I ought to really come on, like, really know what I'm talking about and all that. And it's not that I don't know what I'm talking about or don't understand part of this, but if you think about some of these people running the economy, saying this is, you know, we're going to have this expansive bull market, as they call it. There were books out that were saying Dow Jones 40,000. Now it looks like it sinked to 6,000. And so, I mean, those people didn't know what they're talking about either, although they're just, they have such you know, self-confidence born of this privilege and power they have. By the way, you keep ringing, 313-298-WRIF, and Roger will get to you. But here, steep slide in economy as unsold goods pile up. Well, there's a bit of a difference between overproduction and also underconsumption. It kind of winds up to be the same thing for you and me. But the economy shrank at an accelerating pace last year, according to a government report, and adding to the urgency of a stimulus package capable of bringing the country back from a recession that appears to be deepening. Oh, do you think? And the actual decline in the gross domestic product, almost 4% annual rate, which, and this is not good. Some caution that President Obama's proposals to achieve too many objectives, for example, broader health care coverage and energy efficiency at the expense of focusing tax dollars on the core issue of job creation. Well, I think a lot of you are probably thinking, like, you know, how do I know? I mean, I've heard both sides of this. Here's the government's going to take these hundreds of billions of dollars. Forget about where we're going to get it from. Although I know some of you would say, hey, that's the key. You know, we're just printing money. It's wealth out of nothing, just like what got us into this in the first place. Well, if you got any better ideas, please let us know at 313-298-WRIF. And patience, please. Roger will get to you. Let's see. Others argue that the best bang for the buck would come from a stimulus package devoted mainly to tax cuts rather than public investment. That's the Republicans. I mean, these are the idiots that got us into this in the first place. This is Reaganomics. This is Reagan in this country, Thatcher in Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister of England in the 1980s, decided that all regulation, or as much as possible, had to be withdrawn after, over controlling financial markets. And then with the government out of the way, then there would be this, you know, the market would reward the adventurous, kind of this, you know, idiotic Ayn Rand stuff, this stupidity. We see the wreckage now. We see the wreckage now. But let me see, where there was something in here. That, you know, there's just so much. Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. So they, the Republicans want to give more tax cuts, and I know you by now, I don't have to keep harping on this, that it's not so much that they're going to give a tax cut to the middle class or a tax cut to the working class. It's going to be to the wealthy because they still have this dream. They still have this dream that somehow that these masters of the universe, these financiers, that they can fix it. These are the guys that broke it. These are the guys that broke it. Well, I can't even read my, I take notes on this stuff. I can't even read my own. Oh, yeah. I can't even read my own writing. That's what it said. Economy built on debt. But here's what's happening. So the Republican plan is to give more tax cuts. Let's say that even the middle class, according to the Republican plan, would share in tax cuts. So you give it to the ultra-wealthy, the class that they represent, and you also give it to the middle class, a lot of us, a lot of people, the working class. Well, according to this article from the Associated Press, Americans are hunkering down and saving more for a recession-battered economy. It couldn't be happening at a worse time. Economists call it the paradox of thrift. What's good for individuals, spending less, saving more, is, as you can imagine, bad for the economy when everyone does it. Now, what's going to happen when we get a tax cut? The wealthy have nothing to invest in that's going to be job-creating. That is to say, they gave that up a long time ago. They put it all in speculative capital. They bought all these bizarre financial instruments, these derivatives, all this stuff that no average human being can even understand, and I don't think ultimately even they can understand. But they know that they made these fabulous fortunes. Well, they're not going to be putting it in that. They're not going to be buying these bundled real estate investments. They're not going to be buying derivatives. They're not going to be doing anything. So they, the wealthy, are going to put it in the bank. What's the middle class and the working class going to do? Perhaps, if we're working, it could be spent. But here, this is what's going on at the current time. When the savings rate rises, spending falls. The latter accounts for about 70% of economic activity. When consumers refuse to spend, companies cut back, layoffs rise, people pinch pennies even more, and the recession deepens. So if we get tax cuts, most of it's going to be saved. It's going to have no effect whatsoever. Essentially, this is just a stalking horse, a ploy to get more money to their rich buddies. I mean, they are so obsessive. They are so pathological about wealth accumulation, and most of these people, wealth accumulation way beyond what they can even spend, and they are so in fealty, is that the right word, to the wealthy, that even when it makes no sense, they want to cut taxes on the rich. We should be having astronomically high tax increases on the wealthy, and we'll get into that a little more later on. The downward spiral has hammered the retail and manufacturing industries, you know that. For years, stores enjoyed boom times as shoppers splurged on TVs, fancy kitchen decor, and clothes. Suddenly, frugality is in style. It's because the entire economy, this entire boom, was fueled by debt. By debt. In part by national debt. Remember, Bush, remember that guy who drove the country into debt, that he had a surplus of government funds, and when he left office, we were hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in debt to the Chinese, to the Japanese, to English banks, and what have you. That's part of it. And also it was fueled by individual debt. He said, people would cheerily say, oh, I'm maxed out on my credit card, ho-ho. What do I owe? I owe $26,000. I better, and they want this month $125 or something like that. Well, I shouldn't say finally, because I don't think this has all come to a conclusion, by any means, particularly because the credit card debt bubble, this is wealth. This is, what credit cards are. It's essentially the rich loaning money to classes below them, the middle class and the working class and even the poor, for usurious interest rates. And things that, like in the Middle Ages, would probably get you drawn and quartered or something like that, right? So if people keep losing their jobs, everybody that's got suffering bad times and has high credit card debt, they're not going to be able to pay it. So, I mean, did you ever think about that? You say, I owe money on my credit card, like this piece of plastic is loaning it to you. Well, it's this big bank. or some financial institution that's loaning this to you, and then the profits of the interest that you pay, the debt service, goes to the stockholders. So it's the it's sort of like they don't come break your arms, but it's what do they call that? Not protection. One of those things that the I can't think of it. But you know when the gangsters loan you money, you got to pay it back in a week, or they're going to break your arms. Yeah. The arms and legs of our economic system are being broken. And, of course, the people that made all the mistakes, because you and I, we didn't do anything wrong. We weren't lazy. You can say, oh, I know a lazy guy. You know, I know some woman who was cheating on this or that. The majority, as President Obama says, the vast overwhelming majority of people that work do their job diligently. Many of us have pride in our work. We did what we were told, since the particular, we didn't have even much say in it now that unionization has gone down so much. We literally just had to do what we were told. We didn't have any alternative source of saying, well, we want different conditions or we want this. It was just take orders from the boss or get out. So they made all the mistakes. The common man and woman pay the big costs. Because a lot of these rich guys, of course, I mean, some of them aren't hurting at all after all of this because they're taking the bailout money and, getting their salaries paid and what have you. But the dreams, the hopes, I mean, I can't even begin to understand what it must be to have the rug completely pulled out from under you. We've all seen that if you watch the news. People that were hard workers, that were owning their home, paying on their home and what have you. And suddenly they have no job. They have no home. They have no health care. I can't even get my brain around that. I can, to some extent, of course, and have great sympathy. But the ability to really have it there. And someone I know lost their job, and they wrote me, and they said, I'm such a loser. And I wrote back just angrily, how dare you say that about yourself? You're such a good person, and you've tried so hard. And loan sharking. Thank you. Right, loan sharking. That's essentially what credit card debt is. Loan sharking. Thank you. And but now that totally got me off my mark. Oh yeah. So I wrote them back and I said, look, this is a mass phenomena. People are losing their homes. People are losing their jobs. People don't know what they're going to do for an income. This is a mass phenomena. This is a social phenomena. And you can't beat yourself up about it. People, and, you know, these hard-hearted Republicans say, well, they should have had an alternative skill. Yeah, you work for some firm for 28 years, right? And they tell you, oh, you also should have known how to, I don't know, what? Do something else. Forget it. Let's see. Where's the money going, says this article? The savings account, the debt reduction. That's the other thing that people do. If they get more money, they'll use it to pay down the debt that they have. But for economic purposes, paying off debt and saving are about the same. Incurring debt is negative savings. Paying down debt is savings. So it's it doesn't really make any difference. Let me see here. What else do I have in this pile? They're scary stuff, too, and I don't mean to just scare you. I mean, it scares me, so I don't mean to just scare you, I guess is what it is. But they're like Robert Shiller, who's a professor of economics at Yale University. He said this could go on for about 10 years. He says this is no ordinary recession. There are signs that people see this as a different story. Indeed, people are talking about a depression, something we haven't seen previously. The Dow, this is where I got this from, the bottom for the Dow could be at 6,000. It's about 8,000 now. Last Wednesday, the Wall Street Journal reported that global trade is sharply declining, contradicting the common wisdom only a few years ago that globalism had reached such strength that demand in countries like China would be sufficient for the global economy to weather even a severe U.S. Recession. Now, I'm sure many of you are waiting to hear my solution to it all. Well, I don't know at all, and I'm not sure what's going to happen with this stimulus bill. Most economists on the left say that there is not enough being spent, that $850 billion, $900 billion is not going to be enough, and it's got to go in mostly to infrastructure correction. The Republicans say could go down to defeat. Well, I'd like to see what they have to say. I mean, these libertarian, these right-wing libertarians say that the president should focus on reforms that that remove impediments to work. That means unions, right? They want to break all the unions. Impediments to savings. These people are idiots. They want us to save more, and that's not going to work. Investment in production. So if they have specific proposals, I mean, I'd like to hear them, because I'm sometimes this Keynesian approach, and Keynes, John Maynard Keynes, was an English economist 70, 80 years ago, who said that modern capitalist economies could not function without the government doing massive spending as what they call pump priming. In other words, getting the economy always moving. And this, you know, has it been successful? Some people point to, people are still arguing about the 1930s. Some say that this shows that it didn't work. Others say it did work. Some people say it would have worked if Roosevelt would have spent more. I mean, it's dizzying to all of us. I mean, we should not be put through this by these elites that rule our lives. This is supposed to be a democracy, yet it is an oligarchy. It is a plutocracy. Remember those words? Plutocracy, rule of the rich, oligarchy, rule of the few. Oh, but don't we elect people? Didn't we just have a big elections? Big election? Yeah, but ultimately the key to the social and economic security that we all want for ourselves and our families and our communities is controlled completely by these elites. And we've got to figure out ways to democratize the economy. First off, we should probably obliterate about 90% of the financial industry. That is to say, get back to what you could call a convivial economy, a simple economy that's based mostly on work and providing goods and services. So, you know, a few of us would employ people. This is, you know, a different form of capitalism, but still capitalism. So you'd have bosses and workers. A lot fairer, not such a great a divergence of income the way that we have now. So you have this, literally, this economic royalty. And then, you know, the peons, the peasants on the other end. But all this stuff where you can make money out of money, which is essentially fake wealth. Because if they, all this wealth that was there, I mean, so far they said, I forgot what the figure is, how many trillions of dollars of value has been lost. And one, before this all happened, when everybody was fat and sassy saying, yeah, this is all great and it's going to go on forever and our houses are going to be worth $1 million a piece and all of that. If you would have said, bring all the money and put it on the table, they couldn't do it. It wasn't there. It didn't exist. It doesn't exist. It's a fake. It's a fraud. It's a house of cards. And finally, somebody is, well, I then ripped it out completely from the bottom, but it's beginning to teeter. And if it goes over, those of us in the middle, those of us towards the bottom, we're the ones that are going to get hurt. The big guys always sail through. You read about the 1930s, and what do you ever see these films on television or read about it, and it's always, you know, guys with the crushed hats and looking downtrodden, and they were there, millions and millions of our grandfathers and great-grandfathers and what have you. I mean, that was real stuff. But what they don't show is there was a whole strata of people that bought Packard cars and Cadillacs and had big parties and lived in big houses. And, yeah, they went on like they did in the 1920s. Well, bailout watchdog, which was, you know, they gave this initial $700 million, where there's a congressional oversight panel that said that there had to be a complete overhaul of the regulatory structure of the nation's financial system. Republicans said, oh, no, you know, you're going to interfere with it all. Here we get to the point now, I think some of you have seen this, that this man in Michigan froze to death up in Bay City, even had money. But the fundamentals of life, heating and food, and and water, things like that. They're privileges under this system. They're not our right as human beings. We have to pay for it. And if we can't pay, then we don't have any water. And if we can't pay, we don't have any heat. Or if we don't pay, it seemed like this man may have been suffering some dementia because he did have money. You freeze to death. But we have hundreds and billions and even trillions for war, for the war machine, for the kind of corruption that goes on in these huge financial institutions. I mean, we have the wealth within our country, within the world, that all of this stuff could be free. There's no need for us to pay for it. Like, you know, we're in Cuba, they're always talking about, most of the people live on $20 a month. Well, yeah, they get free medical care and subsidized housing and subsidized food. So, I mean, you know, at one level, you don't need a lot to live. And we want a little more than that, I understand it. But you don't want people dying because of a lack of the fundamentals of life. Oh, yeah, here, too. I love this. The U.S. Executive. Well, here, let me read this for you. Particularly if you've been laid off, listen to this. It's one of the ironies of the U.S. financial bailout, this according to the Associated Press. The banking executives now managing billions in taxpayer money are the same ones who oversaw the industry's near collapse. Right? So all of their bad calls, all of their mismanagement, the corruption, remember, you gotta remember, there was a lot of corruption beyond just Bernie Madoff. They all made off with billions. Total. At banks receiving federal bailout money, nearly 9 of every 10 of the most senior executives from 2006, they're still on the job. Even top executives whose banks made such risky loans they imperiled the economy have been largely spared any threat to their jobs. How about you? You've been laid off? You know anybody that has? Are you fearful for your job? Are you going to get a bailout? Less fortunate are more than the 100,000 bank employees laid off during a two-year stretch when industry unemployment nearly tripled, bank stocks plummeted, and credit dried up. It's hardly a surprise, says the article, that workers and managers experience a recession differently. What's new is that taxpayers are now shareholders in the banks bail out banks, yet they, actually, it should say we, lack the usual shareholder power to question management decisions or demand house cleaning in the executive suites. These guys ought to be out of here, big time, right? And let me see. Jamie Court, president of the California-based consumer watchdog, says, when you deal with the same dogs, you end up with the same fleas. Right? Whew. I was just going to say a word or so. Well, your turn to have your say. But let me do this, because we just have actually just a few commercials tonight. So let me get these out of the way for the bottom of the hour, and I'll be right back to get your calls. I'm Peter Werbe on Night Call. Jalene Jordan is off tonight. You can reach me at 313-298-WRIF. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. Right back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Do you know the difference between the millions of millionaires in this country and you? Simple. They decided they wanted to be millionaires, so they went out and did it. So, do you want to be a millionaire? If the answer is yes, then get ready to write down a number that could change your life forever. Because now you can get a free CD that shows you everything you need to start making the kind of money you deserve with an internet business that virtually runs itself. So you're making cash even while you're sleeping by selling products you don't have to see, store, or even pay for. There are millions of millionaires out there. Don't you want to be one of them? Get the free CD from Internet Speedway and start making money with an internet business that virtually runs itself. For your free CD, call 1-800-339-1419. Deciding to be wealthy is the first step to becoming wealthy. Call now. 1-800-339-1419. The free CD is yours by calling 1-800-339-1419.
Do you know the fastest way to learn a new language?
Memorization?
We always did translation.
Is it drills?
The world's fastest, easiest way to learn a new language is Rosetta Stone software. It doesn't waste your time with tedious translation, useless memorization, or boring drills. Instead, it teaches you a new language the same way you learned your first language. And right now, you can experience it for yourself because Rosetta Stone is offering a free demo CD-ROM. Check out the easiest, fastest way to learn the language of your choice. For the free CD-ROM, call 1-800-441-6151. Discover what U.S. diplomats, NASA, and over 10,000 schools already know that this is the world's fastest, easiest way to learn a language, guaranteed. Choose from 31 languages and request your free CD-ROM today. You'll be amazed at what you learn. Just call 1-800-441-6151. Request your free CD-ROM from Rosetta Stone by calling 1-800-441-6151. That's 1-800-441-6151.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Jillian Jordan off tonight. 313-298-WRIF. I've had my say. Why don't you have yours now? Let's start with Mike from Birmingham. Hey, Mike, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air on WRIF. Thanks for joining me.
How you doing, Peter?
Good.
Yeah, you know what I think is, I believe that George W. Bush's decision to invade Iraq, I believe that one of the reasons he decided to invade Iraq was he was fulfilling biblical scripture, because it mentions in the book of Revelation, the Bible, how Babylon will be fallen, the city of Babylon will be destroyed, and it's like he thinks we're living in end times. Babylon is in Iraq.
Yeah, right. It is. Was.
But that's just a symbol, you know.
Yeah, you know, Mike, I think it was a lot more crass than that. I think it was all about oil. I mean, if he had some, you know, religious whack job ideas running around his head that he was on some mission from God, which didn't he say that a couple of times? I mean, these Christians think God speaks to them. I mean, don't we lock people up that think that, they're hearing voices? But really, I think that mostly was about oil. I mean, these guys, many of these Republicans are pretty crazy, I got to say. And fortunately, I think they're back to the fringe status that they deserve. And it's okay. I mean, it's okay to have, some people think I'm a nut, and my little circles that I travel in are pretty crazy. And so I'm understanding where that's coming from. But, you know, I never tried to force, and I don't try to force my views on everybody else. And that was so wrong with these right-wing Republicans. They represent such a small percentage of the population, but through stolen elections and a coup of almost all the ruling institutions of this country, they forced this terrible set of politics and social ideas on everyone. So they could just go back and talk in tongues and to themselves or something like that, but get away from the rest of us and let us get on with the business of living. All right, thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. Let's see. Here is Katie. Katie's in East Point. Hi, Katie. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good.
Hi, good. The reason why I was calling was just because I am, I'm 28. I'm born and raised in Detroit. I am such a proud Detroiter. And I am so tired of going away parties and seeing my friends having to leave, people who have never dreamed about having to leave the city, who believe in the community, believe in Michigan, and wanted to spend their lives here. And, you know, due to our economic problems, they really have no choice. You know, now I have, more friends in Phoenix and in L.A. than I ever dreamed that I would have. Because everybody's moved from here.
Well, Katie, I was going to ask you, where are they going? I mean, Phoenix, I mean, one of the things that happens if there is a job market in either Arizona or Southern California, if even a few hundred thousand people move there, boom, it's gone, right?
Right, exactly. And, I mean, not to mention the fact that, you know, when water starts becoming, you know, the ultimate commodity, which is going to happen in the next, you know, 20 years,
sure,
you know, they're done for. But, yeah, they all end up going out there because right now, at least, you know, that's where they think that there's a boom. And especially, like, I went to Eastern, you know, big teaching college. A lot of people have to go out there. I had a friend who had to move out to Arizona because he went to school. He was, you know, he did everything right. He was a secondary, teacher for math and science, you know, specialized in at-risk youth. Perfect person to stay here and help out kids. And after 5 years of having this degree and being a substitute teacher, he applied for a job in Arizona and got the job that day.
Wow. Well, Katie, as you know, and most people in Michigan know, good portions of our school, both in terms of class size and the whole the condition of them is absolutely disgraceful. And one of the things that the stimulus bill has in it is billions and billions for education. So hopefully that will turn things around. Who knows, though?
I sure hope so. I mean, I really, and I want to make sure that, you know, I mean, because we got kids here who still need help. And, you know, it just really, it really makes me sad. And that's why one of the things that I hope that, that we see in Michigan, and I hope something that especially the Big Three opens their eyes to, is the concept of public transit. I think that that's something that's really, really pulling people away from being here, because then you have to worry about all these car costs. You know, it's not that people aren't going to still have a car. You still need one. But, you know, public transit is a very important thing I think we need to look at to make sure that young people stay here in the community and work to build it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Thanks for calling in. 313-298-WRIF. Yeah. How about a like a rail system to get around this country? I mean, rather than spending hundreds of billions of dollars every year giving it away to other countries so they can make war. Does that seem the way to go? It doesn't to me. Does it? Well, you let me know what you think. Here's John in Port Huron. He may have an alternate idea. John, hi. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
yeah, I do agree with the last caller, too, as far as what you're just touching on with the public transportation. I think Michigan is probably a, especially the Detroit area, is probably a good example of how horrible it is, the public transportation system is, especially here in Port Huron, too. It's, you hear about bigger cities, how much easier it is to get around if you don't have a vehicle. But anyway, I kind of wanted to pick your brain. I'm trying to come at everything with an open mind here. The stimulus package, the way it's been portrayed, I feel a little bit misled because, and I don't know if you'll agree or not, but it seems there's a bit about, like, Planned Parenthood in there. And, I mean, I understand where I heard an interview with Nancy Pelosi on my way home where she was saying, this, I guess, saving money, whereas, you know, I guess, less mouths to feed maybe is where she was coming from.
You know, that's one of the Republicans' talking points, objection to that there would be this birth control section of it. You know, that's the kind of thing that when it gets out of the Senate isn't going to be in there anymore.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So.
Okay. And then just overall, I guess, what about lowering more taxes? You were touching on that just as I was calling in. I heard you touching on that in the article you were reading, so I was kind of but I only caught a little bit of what you said. So
I think there should be lower taxes for the middle class, certainly for the working class. That's not going to solve our economic problems. I mean, it's two separate things. One, we're paying too much tax for what we get. Essentially, what we get is this enormous military industrial machine that doesn't give back very much in terms of jobs. There's some, obviously, there's thousands of jobs connected with it, but not so that would occur in other government spending. Nowhere near it, as a matter of fact. So give everybody making under $50,000-$60,000 a year a tax cut? Sure, let's do it. On the other hand, what we got to do is start looking at the incomes of these corporations and these individuals that are so out of whack for, you know, and so disproportionate to what other people that are working so hard in the society make. And, you know, they, under this system, they would still be rewarded. But, I'm going to do a little bit on that in just a second. So the point I'm getting at, yeah, we all deserve, need a tax cut, middle class and below, but that's not going to do anything to solve our economic problems.
Okay. Well, just to play devil's advocate on that point for one moment.
Though, wait a minute. I'm the devil's advocate.
just hypothetically, say they did tax cuts across the board, and even like for big corporations and the extremely wealthy that own these businesses and are paying people. One of the arguments I've heard from the crazy right-wingers, too, though, is if their taxes were lower, they would theoretically have more money to pay more workers, creating more jobs, versus if taxes are raised on them, they're going to be even more money-grubbing, getting rid of more jobs, and then it's just going to prolong the problem. I'm just curious, I mean...
Well, it's what I said and what I was reading from that article is in a period like this, if people like us get a tax cut, we don't go out and spend it. I mean, some of us will. I mean, maybe if all of a sudden I realized I had this, I don't know what I would buy right now. But you might go, oh, well, or maybe I will take this trip, or maybe, gee, maybe I'll buy a new car after all. But in the main, when people are nervous about the future, they use more income, whether they get a raise or whether they get a tax break, to pay down debt or to actually just put it in the bank and save it. And like I say, there's nothing wrong with that, and that's good. The more we can pay down debt, the better, for instance, sure, if we have it. But what I'm getting at, that doesn't do anything for what we see as a need for a dynamic economy of consumerism, is that the majority of people who get more money right now, individuals who get more money right now, aren't the little guy, you and me, we're not going to go out and spend it as a group. Like I say, maybe you will, maybe I will, but as a class of people, as a sector of society, we're not going to go out and spend it. So that doesn't work. The ultra wealthy, I mean, some of these, I'm giving away my next little bit. I mean, if you're making $30 million a year and you said, oh, you know what, buddy, you can't make any more than $5 million, well, and one thing, that's income. There's no way a corporation, say a corporation had more money. What are they going to do? They can't, the manufacturing base is all but gone. There's, people aren't buying anything, so they're not going to expand production. There's overproduction now, underconsumption now.
Sure. And, if I may ask one more question.
Sure.
Your opinion of it, with the stimulus and like the bailout and everything else that's happened in the last like 6 to 8 months or so, I heard you mention while I was on hold about us being a democracy, and kind of like somebody I work with brought this point up. He said he kind of lost faith in our democracy when he saw that our government basically jumped in and did the bailout where it was, but there was like, why as a people we don't have a say in like, okay, yes or yay or nay?
It's because the elites are calling the shots, deciding how it's all going to come down, because we're sitting on our duffs, and I'm not being critical of you nor of me,
sure,
because
sure,
what people do at different periods in our history is to move into the arena of history in a mass movement, and that's been done any number of times. That's what created our country. People said, well, we're not going to just sit around. We're going to form our own little country here in North America. But the point being is now we're just hoping that we're out of the grasp of the bad elites, and now
right,
that the good elites are going to make some decisions that are going to help. So hope, what do you hope? You hope when you go out on a picnic it doesn't rain. You hope when
right,
you go to the doctor that lump is benign. But it doesn't have anything to do with your capacity to affect the phenomena that you're hoping will turn out well. It's scary.
Yeah.
All right, let me get on with my next segment. It speaks right to it, okay?
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you. Thank you for calling. All right, eat the rich. They've been eating us, and now they're just gobbling us down and spitting us out. Right? You heard what I said. Spitting us out. Right? Just to be clear on that. 313-298-WRIF. There are open lines. ExxonMobil Corporation on Friday announced that they had ripped and robbed and screwed all of us so bad. Oh, no, it doesn't say that here. I'm making that up. Anyways, they reported a profit of $45.2 billion for 2008, breaking its own record for a U.S. company, even though its fourth quarter earnings fell 33%. I mean, they just couldn't keep the phony price of oil up any longer. So crude was, of course, up to $150 a barrel in July. I think the last I looked, it was $41. But and this $45 billion, besides paying all the executives these extravagant figures and retirement packages and all that, they're giving it to their stockholders because that's the way things are set up legally. Well, things can be altered legally as well. They could say, okay, you made $45 million, you're being taxed $40 million, and your stockholders can split up only a measly $5 billion, right? Aren't we a bunch of commies? Listen, they took the money from us. They gouged us. They charged us these unreasonable prices. They finagled the system to get them $45 billion. And it came out of my pocket and your pocket. If you're in the middle class or your upper class, you know, $4 a gallon, you grumble, grumble, grumble. If you're making $22,000 a year and you've got, you know, one of these old Buicks or something like that that gets about 11 miles a gallon, that's the only way you can get to work. Just think what $4 a gallon would do. You're making $7.50 an hour and you're paying $4 a gallon. Figure that one out. But here, out of the castles, into the ditch, says our little theme there. Just weeks after Citigroup, this is from the New York Post, this is a right-wing paper. Just weeks after Citigroup averted total collapse with a $45 billion shot in the arm of the taxpayer cash. Isn't that interesting? They got $45 billion, ExxonMobil did, and then the same figure with the Citigroup, so they wouldn't collapse. The bank jetted its former CEO, chief executive officer, and his family on one of the corporate jets to a posh Mexican resort for New Year's. That's according to the Post. Sandy Weil hopped aboard the tanking bank's Bombardier BD-700 Global Express on December 26th with his wife, Joan, daughter Jessica, her husband, and their children. They flew from Westchester County Airport to the Los Cabos shore region in sunny Baja, according to the aviation records, blah, 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 blah. The holiday jaunt came the same week that Citigroup, which lost $28.2 billion over the last five quarters. I mean, why is this guy still there, right? They cut 75,000 jobs globally in 2008, agreed to curtail runaway corporate expenses as part of a deal to get the massive influx of federal money. And the new belt-tightening policy went into effect on December 31st while the jet was parked at the Los Cabos airport. While they were there, they had to come back. The family stayed through January 3rd at the ultra-expensive one and only Palmilla in San Jose del Cabo, where a four-bedroom suite costs... Your radio hasn't gone off. This is what they call a dramatic pause. So here... We just paid $45 billion of our money. You know, no universal health care. Schools are going down the drain. We need $2.2 trillion to restore our infrastructure. And remember, I'm always trying to be precise with these pronouns, so I mean this very directly. We, you and me, took our tax dollars, gave it to save Citibank that had made all these awful decisions that created this mess, not only for them, but for us as well. And they are off in a four-bedroom suite, which costs $12,000 a night. $12,000 a night. Can you say eat the rich? Can you say eat the rich? Probably 2 years ago, you'd say, you sound like a commie, Werby. You know, can you say it now? Doesn't it just make you want to eat the rich? It's the same beachfront resort favored by high-wattage stars like Jennifer Aniston and John Travolta. And it's where Eli Manning got married in April. Well, this just goes on and on and on. While one of the richest men in the country was Citigroup CEO until 2003 and its chairman until 2006, then it goes on and on. So, here, the Disney CEO, the Walt Disney Company's chief executive, Robert Iger, received a compensation package worth, dramatic pause, $51.1 million in fiscal 2008, up 85% from a year earlier. Up 85%. Now you say, well, he earned it. I don't even know how you can compute that. I don't even know how you can compute that is worth that. But there's something wrong here. When a guy is freezing to death in his house, froze to death in his house, where they're, somebody froze to death in Detroit, too, just the other day, didn't they? Here's Mexican mogul Slim. Looks like Slim, S-L-I-M, but using the Spanish pronunciation. He's a Mexican billionaire, maybe the richest man in the world. Bill Gates says he's number one, but Carlos Slim, he says, I'm numero uno. And he's sort of a Rupert Murdoch of Mexico. Rupert Murdoch, remember, from Australia, but now owns all this media here in our country. Anyways, Carlos Slim just pulled $250 million out of his pocket and bought a good segment of the New York Times. At some point, we have to intervene in history. Right now, we are the object of history. I don't even know why I got to maybe make these fancy examples, but... An object is something that's acted upon. In other words, what I was saying to our caller before, we can hope that these guys don't screw us too badly. Well, I think that is probably a hope that is not going to be borne out. That the hemorrhaging is going to go on for a long time. People say this is like 1929. Think about this. The Depression went on for 4 years before Roosevelt got into office. So these could be the good old days. And the opposite of being an object in history is being the subject of history, that we intervene in history ourselves, the common people who made the revolution in 1776, who were the movement to abolish slavery, who were the soldiers that fought the slaveocracy and destroyed it. The suffragette movement, the women who finally got the women the vote, the anti-war movements from the Spanish-American War to the First World War to the Vietnam War and the Iraq Wars, and on and on and on. The union movement, certainly of the 1880s and before World War I in the 1930s. These are men and women that made history. They were the subjects of history. They took a period of incredible intensity and crisis and formed it the way we want it, not they, not the elites. The elites have always been in charge here, except when we get our butts into gear, and then suddenly they go, oh, well, yeah, we better do this or that. Did I forget the civil rights movement? I did indeed. But it can be done. And as I say, every time we have this discussion, you say, okay, what do we do tomorrow? I have no idea. There's little things going on. I mean, there's thousands and thousands of us listening. I'm pretty sure there's still the anti-war vigil that occurs every Monday and right near the Ferndale Post Office on 9 Mile and Woodward. And about 5,000 people showed up there rather than the 20 or 25 that'll be there. That would make a big impact, but none of us are going to be there. You know what? Probably not even me this time, although we're starting to talk about Obama's war, aren't we, which I'm going to talk about after the break. But we have, what's that old expression, either we have to hang together or we're going to hang separately. And it's that critical. Many of us ignored the Iraq War. You know, many of us ignored what was happening economically. And we're now bearing the fruits of that. I mean, we have to find some way. And if you're still saying, "What? How do I do it? I don't know. I want to do it. No, you know, no one cares. I'm the only person in my office. I'm the only person in my shop. I'm the only person on my block that even cares." But, you know, they may think the same thing about you. But there is. Either it's happening or it's not. Suddenly, just the 1930s or, you know, the 1950s in the South, all of a sudden everybody knew that there was something to do. Look at, I don't know how many of you know what's going on in France right now, but the working class there is not taking whatever is being shoved down their throats. But one of the things they have, we don't have, of course, is an extraordinarily strong union movement. They lead the way always for resistance against the economic elite that have continual class war going on against us. Sometimes we think, oh, we're part of it. We're middle class, some of us, you know. We're part of that. We're not a worker, you know. We're middle class. We're part of the elite. We've bought this big house, and we have, you know, 7 cars and all this electronic gadget. And all of a sudden, our house isn't even worth as much as we owe, and suddenly we don't have a job and all that. And then that shows us who we are. All right, let me take a couple more calls before our break. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here's Ken. Ken is, where are you on planet Earth, Ken? I don't have it up here on my screen.
Westland.
Westland, thank you. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. Long-time listener, I guess, on and off. Seem to find you about every 3 or 4 years, and after about 5 minutes of listening, get frustrated and turn it off. But decided to call today just because. Couple things I wanted to just mention. I guess, well, first of all, I've heard somebody mention Nancy Pelosi already, so, oh boy, she's a real winner, so can't wait to see what she has to say and do over here the next 4 years between her and Obama. It should be interesting. And I wish I would have listened to you over the last 8 years when Bush was in office, too, because I bet you had some pretty funny stuff to say.
But, well, you missed something. That was a good 8 years, wasn't it? Everything really turned out peachy.
Well, you know, I guess that brings me to that. Yeah, I guess it really wasn't, but I was kind of a home buyer in the 90s.
Yeah.
And let me think. Yeah, that was Clinton. And I bought my first house for 50 and sold it you know, 3 years later for 90, and then bought another one and made 40,000-50,000 on that. And then all of a sudden about 2000, all that kind of came crashing down. And I'm trying to understand how people now, and even people I work with, they're complaining about their, you know, the housing values dropped, and trying to nail that on the Republicans, I guess. And I thought there was rich Democrats too, but maybe there's not. I don't know.
Well, there are rich Democrats. They tend to, most of them tend to have a heart, unlike wealthy Republicans who have none whatsoever, and just are involved in how can they squeeze more wealth out of people and try to keep the little guy down. But
do you expect me to really believe that there's that dividing line between them? I mean, money is money.
Well, yeah, but one of the things that you see with a lot of wealthy Democrats, rather than acting out of their class interest and backing the party that is the party of the rich man, they actually pour money into a party that they see as representing the interests of the average person. They're very free. You know, for a lot of years, if you would have said, oh, both parties are the same and both parties represent corporate interest and the wealthy, and at least the Democrats just want a little bit more to trickle down to the average person, I guess I would have said, you're probably right. But there has been a massive difference now. I mean, the Republican Party is now just the party of pathological greed and pure pathology.
Wow.
Well,
I guess my comment to that, that's a good statement. My comment to that would be, where did Obama get all his money to get elected? This guy came out of nowhere with no money, and in the course of 2 years, now all of a sudden he's our big savior.
I don't know that he's going to be able to save anything. That's what worries me. What do you think would be the situation of, what were their names? John McCain and Sarah Palin. What do you think they would be doing abroad right now?
Well, I'll tell you, you know what, I really, for the first time, and I never really considered myself a Republican, I kind of pretty much voted the issues and my conscience, but it always seemed to wind up being Republican. But I, for the first time, I really had a hard time in that voting booth picking. And as good as Obama talks, and he sure can talk.
Isn't that a nice change, though, just in that? Rather than a bumbling moron who stole two elections in a row?
Yeah, you know what? But you know what? When he talks, he just seems like every other politician out there.
You know,
he's very polished. He's very clean. And I don't buy that. At least Bush, when he flubbed up, at least it was, to me, it was something refreshing instead of just...
Well, listen, I think I don't trust any politician. And I think there's enough corporate money that backed, that backed the Democrats and backed Obama to make me worry about, is he really going to hit at the corporate dominance of the economy and all that. So I agree with you that. Unfortunately, I got to take a break. Thank you. You listened for more than 5 minutes. I appreciate it. Try it again some other
Thanks,
time.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Ken. Bye-bye now.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
See the Wings clash with the Coyotes this Wednesday night. All fans attending the game will receive a WRAF-sponsored flag featuring Wings forward Marian Hossa. Tickets available now at DetroitRedWings.com. Listen to Mike in the Morning on 101 The Riff for your chance to win tickets to the game. Hit the game and get your Hossa flag this Wednesday night from your Detroit Red Wings and 101 WRAF.
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing, and we want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new MKS, the MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. You can check out our vehicle inventory on the site, and you can bet that if you don't see what you're looking for, we can surely find it for you. Experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today, 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com. That's D-E-M-M-E-R.com.
Experience the Demmer difference. Right now at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury, lease a 2009 Lincoln MKS for $379 a month. Based on an AZ plan with Ford Lincoln Mercury lease renewal and $1,969 down plus tax. See dealer for details or check them out on the web at Demmer.com.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Ritz award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour of WRF's Night Call. Jolene Jordan off for the evening, under the weather, in fact, way under the weather with bad flu. Wow, is it flu time already? I never got a flu shot this year. Maybe I'll get one. I don't know. Never mind. Let's not talk about that. 313-298-WRIF. And let's see, David is listening in Walla Walla, Washington, and he says, hi, Peter, good show tonight, even without Jolene. Kudos to her. Anyway, what's the name of the recording artist group for the song Eat the Rich? I like your their theme of late. It is right on. Here's just another little piece of it. Out of the palace and into the ditch. Well, we don't even want to do them that bad. How about just... Whoa. Anyways, that's Crocus with a K from... it was a Dutch metal band, maybe early 80s. Somebody Google it or something and tell me what. I think early 80s. Also, Aerosmith has a song called Eat the Rich as well, where Steven Tyler famously gives an enormous belch before he begins the song. But, look, we've been talking pretty seriously, and, hey, hang on the line. We're going to continue talking seriously, but I thought we would do a little art interlude. You may know that the National Endowment for the Arts, guess what? President Obama and the Democrats actually want us to have a thriving art cultural society where people can see and listen and learn and what have you. Of course, Republicans, they don't want to give any money to that. But here, we don't have anything like this. This only lasted a while. Remember the guy that threw the shoes at Bush? That was one of the best things that, you know, he was on this valedictorian lap. He was going to go to Iraq and say, you know, now this is one of my, my victories. But the guy flipped these shoes at him. Now, the director of an Iraqi orphanage says a sculpture honoring an Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at former President George Bush have been removed. It was this huge shoe about the size of a couch. Fatin al-Nasiriyah says the Iraqi police told her the statue had to be removed from the orphanage in Tikrit because government property should not be used for something with a political bias. She said, oh, here, the sofa-sized statue of a shoe was taken down on Saturday after being unveiled on Thursday. Iraqi journalist Muntahar al-Zaidi threw his shoes during a December 14th news conference in Baghdad. Don't we all know this by now? Throwing shoes at someone is a sign of extreme contempt in Arab culture. And on January 20th, there were demonstrations all over the Arab world where they had these big portraits of Bush and they were throwing shoes at him. And there's still worry, though, of course, about al-Zaidi. His life is in danger in Iraq, and his Swiss lawyer is trying to get him political asylum in Switzerland, in this great democracy. The Super Bowl, I didn't see halftime because I said at the beginning of the show, the last few minutes were sure exciting. I saw that. But I didn't see Bruce Springsteen. Anybody see him and have any comments? What did he sing? Did he sing Born in the USA? I remember, who was it? Ronald Reagan thought it was a patriotic song, didn't understand the poignance of it and all that. Anyway, Springsteen uncharacteristically set up a deal with Walmart to exclusively deal his CD, this compilation. But he's got his new CD out called Working on a Dream. But he says the boss is owning up to a mistake, it says here. In an interview with Sunday's New York Times, Bruce Springsteen says he shouldn't have made a deal with Walmart. This month, the store started exclusively selling a Springsteen Greatest Hits CD. Some fans were critical because Springsteen has been a longtime supporter of workers' rights, and Walmart has faced criticism for labor practices. I mean, they've also faced massive lawsuits because of their labor practices and lost every one of them. Springsteen told the Times that his team didn't vet the issue as closely as he should have and that he, quote, dropped the ball on it. He said it was our mistake. Our batting average is usually very good, but we missed this one. Fans will call you on that stuff, as it should be. And they're beginning another worldwide tour, and they're not coming to Detroit. What's up with that? But I'm trying to think where the closest place was. I know that Philadelphia, that's not very close. But they're going to start in California, go all the way to Spain. Let's see what here. Oh, yeah. You know, you see these portraits, both photographic and drawings of Barack Obama. Think about that. This is pretty amazing. His popularity has kind of made him a marketer's dream, but the honeymoon may be over for those trying to profit from this. White House lawyers want to control the use of the president's image, recognizing the worldwide fascination about Obama's election, First Amendment free speech rights, and easy access to videos and photographs on the web. Brad Adgate, director of the research for Horizon Media, says, I can't remember this ever happening to an active politician before as a spokesman or as an image for a brand. Yeah, I mean, it's, guy's got a lot to live up to. I personally think that Barack Obama will have to find a cure for cancer or people are going to be disappointed. Night Call is what you're listening to. 313-298-WRIF. And, let's go back to our telephones. Courtney in Clinton Township has been waiting a long time. Courtney, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was calling actually to talk about the economy of Michigan.
Sure.
I'm 21 years old, living on my own, and I've tried to get help. I really have. I went to Secretary of State, tried to get food stamps and Medicaid. I make too much money to get help, yet I can't afford to get Medicare or Medicaid. I can barely afford an average $200 to $250 worth of groceries every month.
Yeah.
And I hear these people spend, you mentioned people spending thousands to millions of dollars in a hotel.
Sure.
And it's like, it's ridiculous. And Hollywood stars going over to other countries to adopt kids or spending millions of dollars into donations for countries we barely hear of.
Yeah, billions and billions and billions. And usually it's like, for weapons of war.
Yeah. And it's like we have kids here starving. We have kids here that need help. They're in abusive adoption agencies. They're in adoption agencies where they're molested, where they can barely eat. And we're worried about kids in New Guinea?
Mm-hmm.
It just angers me so much.
Hey, Courtney, do you work at an hourly rate?
Yeah, I work $7.50 an hour.
You know, and you're single, so that comes out to $15,000 a year. And these people that we're bailing out just spent $12,000 a night on there. I don't know what the rates are. Maybe for a single person, $15,000 is, pardon me, too high. But email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and I'll check on that for you. calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Okay.
All right, and we'll see about that. But, you know, there are upper limits, and the state is pretty strapped. More and more people, are applying for food stamps and unemployment benefits. And where this is all going to come from is beyond me. Actually, part of this stimulus package is supposed to be to bail out our states. Because states are talking about doing is raising the gasoline tax, and then so that's going to mean more money when Courtney drives to work for a $7.50 an hour job, a higher cigarette tax, which again, I mean, by the predominantly poor smoke. I mean, other people smoke, but it's more pronounced among poor people, unfortunately.
Well, I live in a place where I can't get Medicare. I can't get help, but people around my area do.
Okay.
They are a minority. where I live. I am one of the few white people in my complex.
Okay.
I think there's three. And everybody here gets Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, whatever. They claim to be disabled, but I've seen things that these people can do.
Well, you know, once, let me tell you this. Once, long ago and far away, I was what they called a welfare worker, and my job was to check for eligibility. And there were numbers of people that were hustling the system, and you got to believe it's a penny ante hustle. I mean, it wasn't an entirely, you know, princely sum, but when you're working at $7.50 an hour, even those little increments can be important. And one of the things that poor people do is try to game the system. It's not legal. It's understandable on one level, but there is not. I mean, they've done these extensive investigations, and fraud is pretty minimal. And one of the things that we see, if we see one person or two people gaming the system, it gives you the sense that that no one is. And one of the things that I would suggest, don't get involved in this pattern of resentment. What you want to do is see what you're eligible for legally, and work at it at that. I mean, what we're really looking for is to create a social and economic situation where people don't have to do that. But there's always some degree of fraud. And I mean, the huge fraud is at the top, right? Those are the people that are scamming us big time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But do that. Yeah. If you feel comfortable, email me and I'll check out. I mean, I know people within the Michigan Department of Human Resources. And in fact, I just saw the director today.
I actually plan on leaving Michigan in about 2 months.
Where are you going to go?
I'm going to St. Marcos in California.
Where is that? What?
About 15 minutes or so, 45 from San Diego.
Well, good luck.
Yeah. I mean, I walk around my area. I can't afford a car, and I see people with brand new cars in my complex. They're dealing drugs out here, and they're still getting their Medicaid. People are having more kids so they can get more money from the government.
You know, Courtney, that is something. I haven't heard that in years, people say that. Oh, these women just have these babies so they can get welfare. I mean, you get so little. It makes you, that every kid you have makes life that much more hard for you on every level. No one is having kids in order to get more welfare. So I'm saying don't even get into that. Don't go there. It makes you less of a person. And, I mean, being poor is really tough. And people do poor people often make poor choices. It's sort of built into the system or it's built into the situation of being poor. You know, the idea is, though, that it's poor habits of poor people that keep them in that situation. But you're poor, and, you know, you have aspirations, and it sounds like you have ambition. Everybody, depending on your station in life and where you came from and what your parents are like and what kind of expectations you have, it gives you a different sense of what's possible. All right, well, give me a holler if you want me to check on it for you. All right, thank you, Courtney, and best of luck in everything. Here's Marty in Lake Orion. Marty, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I was calling. Yeah, I heard you speak about Citigroup, about the $12,000 a night.
Yeah.
And I just had to put my 2 cents in on the whole Citigroup thing. Last time they got their $20 billion, I don't know how many people know, but they spent $10 billion of that on the Swedish corporation. And
buying it. Yeah, they bought
$12,000 a night. I mean, that's just a drop in the bucket when it comes to $12,000 a night on a hotel. I mean, considering what they did with 10 of that $20 billion they had received. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, their deal is that that this gave them greater financial stability because actually, rather than loaning the money, which is what they're supposed to do to get credit going again, they went out and purchased another company, right?
That's right. And I mean, that's where a lot of this big money, I agree with a lot of what you say. I mean, what was the big money? I mean, it's to me, White House isn't even, I mean, our government is ran by money now. That's all it is. I mean, it goes right down to our Federal Reserve and everything. And it's just, it's horrible. And some of these bailouts, I mean, there's got to be a lot more fine print on this stuff, on where it goes and what it needs to go for. I mean, it's supposed to be to pay off bad debts or to survive, and if you get a bailout over the weekend like that, and 10 of it you go ahead and you spend on a foreign corporation, that just makes absolutely no sense with the U.S. citizens' money.
Sure. Well, it's this period of blackmail that we're in, because they say, hey, you know, we made all these bad decisions, but if we collapse, the whole system's going to collapse. So you got to give us money. Do you want everything to collapse, or do you want to give us the money? Well, I mean, that's a shakedown. That's highway robbery. But we're right now in a position where we can't even refuse these folks. All right, thank you very much. Yeah, it is galling, isn't it? Well, but here, you know, sometimes I just see these things. By the way, 313-298-WRIF. There's an open line, one at least. I just, normally I wouldn't even have read something, and sometimes I will, about an election in Kenya, right, in Africa. But it had a little part of the headline in the New York Times the other day, January 31st, that was intriguing. A chaotic Kenyan vote and a secret U.S. exit poll. Yeah, we see stuff like that all the time. But here is the report. For 3 days in December 2007, Kenya slid into chaos as ballot counters steadily took what appeared to be a presidential election victory for the challenger and delivered it to the incumbent. Well, we know what things are like in a lot of those countries. As tensions mounted, Kenneth Flatman sat in Nairobi, the capital, and grew increasingly frustrated. He had in his hands the result of an exit poll paid for by the United States government that supported the initial returns favoring the challenger, Raila Odinga. Then it goes on, the whole thing. And it's just about the impact that this, that the exit poll would have had on the politics of the country. Of course, here in Ohio, in 2004, when the exit polls showed an overwhelming victory for John Kerry, and then suddenly by the same margin of victory in the exit polls that were shown in the Ohio balloting, that's where Bush stole the election, it was flipped, and somehow Bush won the election in Ohio by the same amount. But this is all right. But here's my concern here. The result of an exit poll paid for by the United States government. Where did the United States government get its money? Well, we all know that. It got it from you and me. Courtney's paying maybe she doesn't pay any tax, but she's being paid $7.50 an hour, an outrageously low sum for working someplace. Part of that, if she's paying taxes, part of my tax dollars, I know, maybe part of yours, is going to pay for an exit poll for an election in Kenya. Now, why would we be doing that? Well, it's advanced democracy everywhere. That's not true at all. There's some concern by people, to be sure, that we live in a democratic world, which we don't. The United States has all sorts of relationships with some pretty miserable dictatorships that don't allow any democracy, particularly in Central Asia. But be that what it may, the United States, and representing almost always corporate interests, and has done this for the last 100 or so years, sees the events around the world as being in, quote, our national interests. That's why we're fighting wars in Asia. That's why we're fighting wars in the Middle East. That's why we give billions of dollars to everybody. You know, we're going to modernize the Polish army. We're going to give Israel and Jordan and Egypt billions and billions and billions of dollars. That's why we give Kazakhstan and Tajikistan and places like that millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. We got to get out of that mindset. We got to get back on, you know, I know everybody doesn't listen to the show straight through, but we got to create a convivial economy, a simple economy, rather than an enormously complex economy that extends this military-industrial complex that takes our money and spends it on things like an exit poll paid for by the United States government in Kenya. All right? What else is under here? Well, this is good. Under Obama, the war on terror catchphrase is fading. In other words, we're not going to be using that anymore. The war on terror. All that hyperbole, right, that exaggerated use of the word war, war on drugs, war on poverty, what that means is an intense effort. But it also, particularly when there actually was a military engagement, we were struck by these right-wing religious nuts from our, that most of who lived in our ally, or from the country of our ally Saudi Arabia, which we also give billions of dollars to for some reason I don't understand, that this gave Bush an excuse to shred the Constitution. So it's good that, that's disappearing. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. And let's see here. Let's talk to Colin. Colin's in Highland. Hi, Colin. Thanks for joining me. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to have a couple questions. I've been listening to you talk for a little while. A couple questions about you were talking about the stimulus package, the second one. But honestly, what happened to the first one? What happened to that 800, what was it, 800 or some?
Billion. Yeah.
It just kind of vanished.
Well, Bush, that was Bush's. Bush gave our money to all these financial institutions. Well, he actually did stop the infusion of that that cash. In fact, did stop some of these financial institutions from going bankrupt. But they won't, we don't know. I mean, there's supposed to be this oversight committee. I mentioned it's called COP, Congressional Oversight, something like that. And they can't get all the information. I mean, we gave these people money, and when we say, well, tell us what happened to it all, they don't come up with the answers.
It,
you know, I mean, I don't think they're, I don't think they're diverting. It's like our one caller said. I mean, they'll do things like, you know, buy other companies. They're not using it to extend credit, that's for sure. You know, it's still.
Yeah, definitely not. I mean, I just applied a little bit ago because I run on a junker car, old Tracer. I've been driving for 2 years now, and I look to try and get a new car. My credit score is around 600.
Uh-huh.
And they said, oh, yeah, yeah, about a year ago, we could have put you in a brand new car with it, with this credit score. But now you need at least 700 to get anything, absolutely anything. They were going to give me buy here, pay here.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, forget that. I'll just keep driving what I got for free, because what I got for free is the same thing I get for buy here, pay here.
Sure.
So, yeah. I mean, there's no credit. There's no credit anywhere. I mean, and I keep hearing on the radio, too, about how I can get credit somewhere. And I don't understand, where can I go to get credit? Because I don't see anywhere.
Yeah, I see some of these ads on television talking about zero APR, annual percentage rate. I'm going, well,
Yeah, yeah.
It's called the Congressional Oversight Panel, COP, interestingly, and they're supposed to oversee the $700 billion bailout of the financial institution industry. But who knows?
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here's Maurice in Detroit. Hi, Maurice. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing, man?
Doing good.
You know, I got a question to ask you, a question.
Sure.
No. Don't you see a similarity between this little recession, the depression, comparing it to the Great Depression of the 30s?
Well, it's looking like it's heading that way. They're talking about unemployment over 10%. And, you know, I think you know, Maurice, that they count people that are receiving unemployment benefits. If you run out of unemployment benefits and you're not reporting all the time, like to the Michigan Employment Security Commission, they consider you a discouraged worker because you're not coming back there all the time to try to see if they've got a job for you, which they never do or rarely ever do. So who knows what the real unemployment rate is to begin with, and this is continuing to spiral downward, right?
Peter.
Yeah.
What the heck? What in the hell happened to our Pistons?
What happened to what?
What happened to our damn Pistons? We used to be an elite team.
Yeah.
Tell me. I don't know.
I don't know either. I just, you know, someone said, wasn't I going to watch the Super Bowl all the way through? I saw the last part of it, which was the most exciting part. But I said, I'm going to watch all the Super Bowl when the Lions are in it, right? When do you think that's going to happen soon?
When hell freezes over.
Exactly. Thank you, Maurice. Appreciate your call. Hey, one really important major development. A Russian news report on Wednesday said that Russia is putting off its plan to deploy missiles near the Polish border, raising speculation that the Kremlin is trying to lower the tension with the new Obama administration. This is so extraordinarily important. Because remember, Bush was cranking up the Cold War because he wanted this atmosphere of fear and preparation for war, because that's his Keynesianism. The brand of economics where the government spends enormous amount of taxpayer dollars, but rather than on civilian needs like schools and infrastructure and stuff like that, the whole idea of these Republicans is you spend it on preparation for war. So they had really forced Russia to respond when they're talking about putting missile defense systems in Poland and in Czechoslovakia. And that's what I said earlier. As part of the deal, Poland said, okay, we want you to modernize our armed forces. Why should Poland have a modern armed force? What are they going to do? Who are they going to stop? Germany? Russia? You know, they played that out in the 20th century. I mean, most countries do not even need an army, shouldn't even bother with it. I know you Canadian listeners always go crazy when I say that that Canada ought to disband its armed forces entirely. Why are you wasting money on that? There's only one country that will ever invade you. It's a little bit to the south of your borders, and you couldn't stand up to that power anyway. So you might as well go like Costa Rica. Are there any other countries without armies? Costa Rica just has cops, and that does fine. But anyway, this is extraordinarily important that this could ratchet down the thousands of weapons that you knew that, right? That Russia and the United States still have pointed at one another. And it looks like all these treaties that Bush just threw in the toilet are going to get resurrected, and they're going to start looking again about how do we create nuclear disarmament. Very important. 313-298-WRIF, and let's see, here is Joe's in Fenton. Joe, thanks for waiting so long. I appreciate it.
Hey, how you going?
Good.
You're talking about, I'm losing my train of thought here. I've been on a long time.
I know. You know what? I'll give you a chance. Let me just tell you something. I lose my train of thought all the time, but after a bunch of years doing this, I learned how to fake it.
Well, you talk about the COP, the Congressional
Oversight
Committee. Now, isn't that all? That's been Democrats for how long? And they didn't watch to see what Bush was doing with all that money?
This is not, this was just Bush appointed this as part of the Bush bailout, you know, the last part of his administration. This was the Congressional Oversight Panel.
Congressional means that it's part of Congress.
Yeah, but
which is run by the Democrats.
Yeah, I forgot the composition of it, though.
I mean, he can make the minority the rulers of it. Usually the majority is the one who runs the committees.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it changed. Maybe because the Democrats were the chair. The five-person oversight panel consists of three Democrat chosen members and two Republicans.
And the Democrats couldn't decide what was going on with it?
No, they can't get the information from them, and there's not like an enforcement mechanism, you know? I mean, they said, we want the information. Where are you spending this? Where is it all going? And these companies don't come up with the answers.
Pelosi, she come up the other day and she said, well, we're going to regulate this next $750 billion, but that was Bush's $750 billion, like they just kind of turned their head and looked the other way and said, this is his, it's his presidency. Well, she was still in charge and she still had the power, but they didn't want to look at it.
Well, listen, I think they were really remiss. I mean, remember, Bush had this three-page, instead of this, you know, how legislation usually is, he came up with this three-page little proposal. But this TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program, I don't know who it's relieved other than the banking stockholders. And what do you say? Are you trying to tell me that you think the Democrats should have been more vigilant? I agree with you 100%.
No, it hasn't relieved anybody. I mean, I'm middle of the road. I'm watching both sides, and they're both screwing us to death. But
well, we'll see. They didn't, what I said, they weren't vigilant enough. They had pretty much of a mandate to stop Bush in 2006 and didn't do anything near what they could have done. And in that regard, bear some of the responsibility. I absolutely agree with you. Are things going to change dramatically under Barack Obama? We shall soon see, right?
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Also, with the stimulus package, half of the stimulus that's coming to Michigan is going to pay off Graham Holmes' deficit, which she told us 2 years ago we weren't going to have for 5 years because she got everything in order and everything was going to be good to go.
What do you think? What do you think Granholm did wrong or didn't do what she should have done? I mean, I don't think it's the economy. I don't think it's fair to put anything on her.
No, it's not all her, but I mean, it's most of the government. It's not just. I mean, I blame both sides all the way down the line.
Well, I don't think you'll go wrong doing that to some extent, unless it really just puts you in a position of such cynicism that. I don't know. I mean, if it's an accurate view of things, but things are pretty desperate right now, and it's all going to come out in the wash. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate you calling. Let's see. Roger, who's answering our phones at 313-298-WRIF, says Haiti, Grenada, Panama, and Iceland don't have armies, and Costa Rica as well. So let's see. Haiti is a total mess. I haven't heard of Grenada since that fake invasion that that Bush 1 pulled off at the end of the 80s. And Iceland, again, why would they have an army? Why would they waste their money on an army? Why would Canada waste their money? I mean, you get some Canadians complain about the health system not being fully funded enough, and then billions are spent on this army to protect itself from who? And people say, well, you know, we want to have, we want to be peacekeepers. Send a few thousand troops to Afghanistan. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but it's your country. Isn't that a song or something like that? This is you? I can't sing, never mind. Here's Mike in Farmington. Hi, Mike, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
What's going on, Peter? How you doing?
Good, just doing the show.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm actually eating in the middle of a bunch of chips. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Do you want me to put you on hold?
No, I'm good.
Go ahead.
We're good. I'll talk through it. All right. I got to say right now, here's the biggest thing I have to say about defense spending. Number one, they trump about everybody here. You know, you hear it from all the way down from the Joe Schmo, the political, you know, the pundits on TVs. You hear about everybody else. I've never seen a terrorist. Okay. Have you ever seen one, Peter?
Only on television.
Okay. Well, here's the biggest problem about that. I've never seen one. So for me personally, I would consider myself to be both enough of a liberal and at the same time a conservative. And I've grown up middle class all the way in my entire life. Mm-hmm. My mom was a teacher in a Catholic school for 37 years before she retired. So it's very, very hard for me to go and look at a situation like this that's going on with the world. I have friends that are serving. They've done it entirely for wanting to join the service. You know, they believe it's what they're doing correctly, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it's very, very hard to go and look at that and say, how can I relate to what is coming back with all the money that you're saying, you know, you're spending on defense, you're spending on this. I have my friends come back. They're mentally not able to comprehend their real-life situations that they used to have. What kind of benefit is going into, you know, your PTSD syndrome, kids, 19, 20 years old. What comes from that to me?
Well, I know. You know, they've just, again, a record number of suicides of Iraq and Afghan veterans. I think last year, at least, and they're still looking at 15 others, at least 128 service people have committed suicide in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
That's going. Hey, you know, actually, it's interesting you brought that up. Because at 1 a.m., I'm going to be, which is 29 minutes from now, I'm going to be airing an interview with Aaron Glantz, a guy who was a reporter in Iraq and has interviewed all these vets. And his book is called The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. And he talks about exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Like in World War II, they come back. What kind of support system? Vietnam, they come back. They're, you know.
World War II, they had a lot.
Assaulted. Yeah. You know, you get assaulted by the same crowd and the people that you signed up for to protect.
Well, I don't think there wasn't any assaults on people. But World War II, it was, a clear victory. I mean, there hasn't been a lot of clear victories. Well, what? Oh, yeah, Bush invaded Panama and Grenada. Or was that? Maybe, wait a minute, maybe Reagan did one of those. I can't remember now. But, yeah, there hasn't been these clear victories. But even still, just the nature of battle is such that people that have been sent off to fight by our government need extraordinary care. And once they've been used and abused, cannon fodder for Bush's war, they ought to be treated a lot better than they are. And that's the opinion of our guest. So that'll be on at 1 a.m. Thanks for your opinion, Mike. Appreciate it. Thanks a lot for joining us. What did I I thought I had something else right here. All right. Well, we will go on. 313-298-WRIF. I know. That's what I wanted to do. I have to take our little break. Peter Werby with you. Jalene Jordan off tonight. 313-298-WRIF.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
If your credit card debt has gotten out of control, if you're over your head at monthly payments, here's one powerful secret the credit card companies don't want you to know. You have the right to settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, allowing you to cut your debt up to half or more. That's bad news for credit card companies, but it's great news for you. We're Consumer Debt Advocate, and we'd like to offer you a free consultation that will help you start eliminating credit card debt. For your free consultation that will set you free, call 1-800-984-6953. Don't ruin your credit by declaring bankruptcy. Settle your debt and move on with your life. During your free consultation, you'll find out what the credit card companies don't want you to know. For your free consultation that will help you settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, call today. The number is 1-800-984-6953. 1-800-984-6953.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Also, besides Aaron Glantz, who I will be interviewing at 1 a.m., who's written The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. Also, Charles Braceland Flood, an historian who wrote a book called 1864, Lincoln at the Gates of History. So it's a book about history, but since President Obama refers frequently to Lincoln and the iconography, if you will, you know, standing in front of the Lincoln Memorial and all that, I thought it'd be interesting to check this out. It's a very interesting interview. We did it earlier this week. By the way, the recession has taken a number of turns. Executions and new death sentences continued their nationwide decline in 2008 as states wrestled with legal, moral, and financial concerns about capital punishment. 37 people were executed in 9 states. That's it. Michigan has the honor of never having had a state execution in its entire history. It became a state in 1837. It's the lowest total in 14 years, 62% drop from the 98 death sentences carried out in 1999. You know, one of the things in the Constitution, it says, cruel and unusual punishment are forbidden. Of course, the Founding Fathers understood what horrible punishments these countries in Europe and England, where they had come from, had practiced upon prisoners, so they put that in there. And very frequently, when people are challenging the death penalty legally, they say it's a cruel penalty, particularly when some of these, what do they call that? You know, they put them on the gurney and lethal injection, that's a cruel punishment. But really, what it's turned out to be is an unusual punishment. I forgot how many murders there are in a year. I mean, there's tens of, well, somebody go to, as Bush used to say, go to the Google, someone, or Roger, go to the Google and tell me how many murders there were in 2008. 37 people. That's pretty unusual. I know there were thousands of murders. So, I think that qualifies as an unusual punishment. And also a total of 111 death sentences were handed down in 2008. Fewest since executions resumed in 1976. One of the reasons the states don't want them and prosecutors don't want them is that they were so complicated. They take so much resources and they take so much money. they cost the state so much money, so states don't even want to deal with them. So if, you know, you love the thought of malefactors being fried or poisoned or whatever they do to them, I guess you're going to be disappointed. Sorry about that. All right, let's see. Here's Don in Clinton Township. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing, Peter Harvey?
Doing well.
Good. I agree with everything you've been talking about.
Oh, good.
Let me tell you, you are right on, brother. Are you there?
I'm there, letting you talk.
I think you got a great show and all that. I'm a Democrat. I've always been, and you know, I voted for Obama, I voted for 11, I voted for all of them, but you know, I go both ways sometimes on some issues, you know, but mostly a Democrat. But these are historic times we are living in. And this is the Great Depression number two. You know the old saying, you say recession, I say depression. You know?
Right.
Right? So I, you know, the only way I can see that we get out of this is, you know, my dad used to say, God bless his soul, he's passed now, charity begins at home. And we have to take care of our own people, everybody here first, you know, in our country at this time, because we are in a Great Depression. Don't let anybody tell you, I'm not talking about you, but don't let anybody be fooled. We are in a Great Depression right now. And this is different from the other depression in 1929 or whatever, 30. You know, this started in the United States. And the heck with the banks. Don't bail out those damn banks. When they go out and buy them god darn million-dollar planes and shit, the hell with them. Okay? That's all either. That you know, the banks that did a good job, take care of them. You know, and the ones that are buying planes, forget them. You know, buy what you can eat, drink, and smoke. If you can't eat, drink, or smoke it, if you're going to buy it, you know, if you're going to buy something else, you know, as far as what you buy for yourself or for Wall Street, if you're going to buy socks or whatever, if you can't eat, drink, or smoke it, don't buy it.
Well, here, let me just interrupt you just for a minute there, Don, because the problem, I agree with you, but if everyone consumes on that level, like I do, like you're advising people to do, well, the motor of the economy won't work. The economy, unfortunately, is based on this hyper consumption, and that's why I'm saying we got to work out a more calm. I can't think of a better word. A more calm economy that doesn't always have to expand, that doesn't have to grow endlessly. Because there's some point, even you're going to wind up hitting an environmental war. War. That's interesting. That's an interesting slip. Wall. An environmental wall. I mean, right now, in terms of the world economy expanding, are we really talking about half the people in China having automobiles and burning fossil fuel? Or half the people in India buying automobiles and burning fossil fuels? You know what that will do to the planet? Boom. Talk about lethal injection. That will do it. All right, Don, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. On the road, Henry is driving, and he is on the air right now. Hi, Henry.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good.
I've been listening, you know, to the show, and I think a lot of people are really missing, like, the point of globalization, which was the usurpation of individual rights throughout the world.
Okay.
I worked for a company whose president at one time said that the American people or the people in the West are going to have to lower their standard of living to that of the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was one of our big three that was here in the Detroit area. And since that time, that's exactly what I've seen going on. And with Bush destroying the Constitution and elevating the rights of corporations above that of people, I think that we're seeing that it was all a plan to preempt any kind of revolutionary or radical movement against them. And the thing that really scares me is that all of our people in all the Democrats in Congress kind of just acquiesced to all of this. And does that mean that they accepted it or they were coerced into it?
Or they, you know, it's just a system that has institutionalized what is, and any trying to, you know, what's that cliche about thinking outside the box? I was just at a talk today where I heard the third chairman of the Democratic Party in Michigan talking, and he said, you can't depend on the Democrats. I mean, this is a man from the party. It's like I've been saying. He said, we've got to have these social movements that put their feet to the fire, and if that doesn't move them, we got to go around them.
Yeah.
I said the last part.
Well, you know, and I realize this is true, but it's like the scary thing is that I guess people were, you know, crying the alarm about what was happening to our constitutional rights,
mm-hmm.
not just, you know, our rights as citizens in this country and just basic human rights around the world. But there was very little being said about it, and people were acquiescing to it because, you know, we were fighting, as you mentioned, this war on terrorism. And it reminds me of H.L. Mencken when he said, you know, that given a choice, the American people will always choose security over liberty.
Well, of course, what's happened now is we've got neither. All right. Henry, thanks for calling. Drive now. We'll talk later. Thank you so much. In fact, I think many of you know that. Where did I just grab that? Yeah. National Safety Group is advocating a total ban on cell phone use while driving, saying the practice is clearly dangerous and leads to fatalities. But what I was talking about, the environmental wall, climate change is, quote, largely irreversible for the next 1,000 years, even if carbon dioxide emissions could be abruptly halted, according to a new study led by the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. The study's authors said there was no going back after the report showed that changes in surface temperature, rainfall, and sea levels are, quote, largely irreversible for more than 1,000 years after CO2 emissions are completely stopped. It showed that human choices on carbon dioxide emissions are set to irreversibly change the planet. Choices that we have made. And, you know, we didn't really make it. I mean, nobody understood the impact of the internal combustion engine. We never got to vote on it. No one ever evaluated it for what sort of impact the insertion into the planetary comings and going was going to have. And I don't know if there's, back then, I don't know if there's any way that they could have. If somebody said, for instance, we were going to introduce this machine that would cause hundreds of billions of dollars of damage, take millions of lives over its life, be the weapon of war that would increase casualties astronomically, everybody would have said, well, you know, I think we'll just do it with the horse and buggy, right? But think about things like genetically modified organisms. These things, these Frankenstein genes are being developed by these companies that want to control food stock, and there's no idea whatsoever about what would happen if they begin to alter the wild stock. And yet this goes on. And there's just more on that. Unprecedented heat will trigger global food crisis. President has 4 years to save the Earth. This is the stark assessment of NASA scientist and leading climate expert Jim Hansen. Now, fortunately, and I don't know if this again is going to be enough, but President Barack Obama has begun reversing the climate policies of the Bush administration on Monday, clearing the way for new rules to force automakers to produce more fuel-efficient cars and ones that do less polluting. But it's like the bailout. It's probably not enough. I mean, and the nature of all bureaucracies is so conservative that to say, hey, we've got to just alter everything completely, people would freak out. But if we really knew that this was literally life or death, wouldn't we be more susceptible to making epochal changes? I would hope so. All right, a few more calls, and then we're through for the night. We might need a few more, Roger, so don't put the lines on hold. Let's take a look and see how that goes. So you may try to sneak in. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Evan in Canton. Go ahead, Evan. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Doing good. Thank you.
I got a question. Have you ever read the book, The Creature of Jekyll Island?
That sounds familiar. No, remind me about it.
I personally haven't read it, but I've read portions of it, and it's about the creation of the Federal Reserve. It's an actual island off the coast.
Oh, that's where Jekyll Island, that's where they had the meeting. That's where they had the meeting to establish the Federal Reserve Act.
Correct.
Or the Federal Reserve itself, and then they passed the Federal Reserve Act.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at the time that it was created, supposedly the public was an outcry to break up the banks because they had too much power.
Yeah, they created this panic of 1907 and all that, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, essentially it was the banks that wrote the Federal Reserve, which was initially supposed to break up this power.
Right.
And then, you know, from my understanding, they just changed the laws to make it work for the way that they wanted it to work.
Well, they were interested in not having these enormous fluctuations in the economy from bust to boom. There was, you know, huge depressions in other areas, like in the 1890s, and they wanted to set up the Federal Reserve so that another depression wouldn't occur. Well, I guess that didn't work too well, huh?
And I guess, you know, the point I'm trying to get to and maybe understand your opinion would be, how do we get that view back to the people where we need to get these banks out of having so much power because the government's taking money whenever they want and it's all ending up in the bank's pockets at some point?
Well, it begins with an R, and I used the word at the beginning of the show, revolution. And, you know, a few years ago, probably would have said, people are, you know, you're crazy. Well, you know, usually we think of revolutions like the one that established our countries, people fighting in the streets with guns and in the fields and shooting each other with muskets or whatever, you know, a little different now. But that's how we're taught. Revolution means turning things over, and things have to be turned over completely. Things are totally out of whack now. It is like the 1870s or the 1880s with these huge robber barons that control everything. And, they, you know, remember, they put in all of these acts, the Sherman Antitrust Act, so you wouldn't have these big, huge conglomerates controlling everything. Well, now it's just these financial institutions that control everything. It's not the big industrial concerns the way they were back then. But we've got to figure out a mechanism, a political mechanism. It's not the Democratic Party, that's for sure. Maybe, I mean, I think Barack Obama is way better than a stick in the eye, and that's what McCain and Palin would have been. I mean, a continuation of the Bush administration policies, which were, you know, I can't even imagine what would happen or what we'd be like now. I mean, we'd be, not only would we have no policies, we would, in fact, be hopeless. Can Barack Obama and the Democrats pull it out? Well, I don't know. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to have to, I just noticed I got a lot of callers suddenly, so I'm going to have to do these callers a lot quicker because we're towards the end of things. So thank you. Appreciate your call, and we'll just take these in order. Hopefully we will get folks on. George and Troy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I love your show, and you are the only liberal voice on radio right now. I just wanted to say that we need to nationalize all the banks so that they do what we need them to do.
Well, you know, they're going that way certainly in England, and when we start becoming shareholders, that they're nationalized to some extent. The only thing that's different is we give them the money, we become shareholders, they still pardon me, control everything. That ain't good. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Rick in St. Clair Shores. Hi, you're on the air.
How are you doing?
Good.
I love your show, man. Great show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to bring up something about the security and the, 9/11 in the Middle East. And I think it's all been because of the Jewish influence in this country and the lobbyists.
No, I don't think that's the case.
You don't believe that? I mean, the biggest threat to the Jews over there was Saddam Hussein. He had a million-man army.
When? Just now?
No, before they attacked him.
You mean in 2000?
Before he went to war with him.
No, no. He had an army of dust. He didn't, Israel didn't think that the, nobody thought that Saddam Hussein represented any threat to anyone. The Saudi, he never did. he didn't back, in the Gulf War. It's just, U.S. ally went bad. And so, like, Bush 1 and then Bush 2 could, you know, use him for kind of a political punching bag and also, you know, to rationalize the military-industrial complex. You know, talking about the influence of the Jews gets us nowhere because that they have a say in Middle East policy because they have a lot of money to be a pressure group. But I'll tell you, they would be cut loose in a second if interests change because one thing, the Saudis have enormous power over U.S. policy as well because of the control they have of oil. So it's all who's got the money. That's how you can call the tune. I mean, we give Israel money. We also give Egypt money. We give Saudi Arabia money. We give Jordan money. Billions and billions and billions of dollars. Nobody should get it. We need it right here. And it's just a process of continuing the war. In fact, the people that hate us so badly right now wouldn't hate us so badly if we were out of there, if we weren't backing different regimes. If we, you know, there's people that hate us because we're backing the government of Egypt. There's people that hate us because we're backing the government of Israel. There's people that hate us over there because we're backing the government of Saudi Arabia. And if we moved out of there, or we said to them, hey, here's the deal. Here's what you got to do. You got to make peace, and here's the basis that you're making peace between Israel and the Palestinians, or you don't get any more money whatsoever. We could probably accomplish it. We can't let other countries call the tune, and because we're so dependent on oil, we got to disengage from the Middle East. We got to disengage from Asia. All right, thank you. Let's see. Here is Tim in Riverview. Quickly, Tim, I think we just got a little bit of time left. Oops, sorry. Go ahead. You're on the air. What? Go ahead. You're on the air.
It's Ed, not Tim.
Oh, okay, Ed. Go ahead.
How you doing, Peter? Has Good. Anybody actually, I kind of came in late into the show, has anybody even, like, poked fun at this new stimulus package and the fact that it's so far loaded down with pork spending? It's ridiculous.
There is some. I don't think it's going to make it through the Senate. In the main, it's not loaded down with pork, but that's one thing that the Senate will do, and that's one of the things that the Republicans objected to. And I think Obama really wants at least the appearance of somewhat of a bipartisan bill, so I think most of that will be gone.
Well, I hope so, because, you know, funding for condoms and Filipino war vets and, you know, whatever else they can seem to get their, you know, greedy hands on to filter off into the different areas is just ridiculous.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I've just heard that stuff about the condoms. Hey, you know, maybe that'll create jobs. The condom makers. What about Trojan? What about those workers? All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. I got to look at that bill more. Pardon me, man. Me and Jalene talking part of the time here. I'm too worked up. That means I'm talking from my throat and not from my diaphragm, right? Here's James in Redford. James, hi, you're our last caller. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing? I just want to throw this out as kind of a thought. I really do feel that economically we really need to focus on our internal economics and our outsource, because I don't know if anyone realizes it, but essentially we're doing the Rome complex.
Yep.
Which is that we're focusing all our resources to our borders, to the outside, and we're not really realizing what's going on the inside. And because of that, internally we fall apart. We lose our funding and what we do internally because we're so dependent on everyone else's resources and incoming and outcoming.
Yeah, well, it's the cost of empire, actually.
Right.
Yeah. And then the
fear of the part of the fear about it is, if you think about it, if that crashes, I mean, tensions are still high in the world, and if the superpower falls, everyone's going to want to get dibs while he's down. So, I mean, I think really, really, we should really focus on rebuilding our internal economic structure.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you for being our last caller. I appreciate it. You have a good evening. And actually, I wanted to read this. I was talking about the songs Eat the Rich by Crocus and Aerosmith, and Doug in Ontario listening said, indeed, that Motorhead had one as well. Oh, boy, this just got Joe asks, why is gas back to $2 a gallon? Good idea. Xavier writes and says that, this is interesting, that there wasn't big corporate funding for Obama, or, sorry, Paul, it is. Paul writes that, $200 and under, that Barack Obama raised $334 million, 2,000 and over, it was, well, let's go 1,000 and over, it was, oh, I don't know, about almost 200,000. But it was really a mass movement. It really was a mass movement to put a Barack Obama in office, to be sure. All right, thank you for listening. Thank you for calling. Let's send a lot of good vibes out for Jalene Jordan, who is under the weather. And I'll be right back with an interview with Aaron Glanz. He's written the book, The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. And the whole thing about care for our veterans. And also Lincoln and Obama. That's all coming next on Night Call. We'll talk next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
See the Wings clash with the Coyotes this Wednesday night. All fans attending the game will receive a WRAF-sponsored flag featuring Wings forward Marian Hossa. Tickets available now at DetroitRedWings.com. Listen to Mike in the Morning on 101 The Rip for your chance to win tickets to the game. Hit the game and get your Hossa flag this Wednesday night from your Detroit Red Wings and 101 WRAF.
Do you know the difference between the millions of millionaires in this country and you? Simple. They decided they wanted to be millionaires, so they went out and did it. So, do you want to be a millionaire? If the answer is yes, then get ready to write down a number that could change your life forever. Because now you can get a free CD that shows you everything you need to start making the kind of money you deserve with an internet business that virtually runs itself. So you're making cash even while you're sleeping by selling products you don't have to see, store, or even pay for. There are millions of millionaires out there. Don't you want to be one of them? Get the free CD from Internet Speedway and start making money with an internet business that virtually runs itself. For your free CD, call 1-800-339-1419. Deciding to be wealthy is the first step to becoming wealthy. Call now. 1-800-339-1419. The free CD is yours by calling 1-800-339-1419.
Attention. Hydralyze is currently seeking participants with dark circles and puffy eyes. If you have dark circles or bags around your eyes due to heredity, fatigue, or aging, you are now eligible to try Hydralyze free. Hydralyze was introduced to improve delicate skin around the eyes and now has been shown to eliminate dark circles and bags. It effectively diminishes even dark circles caused by heredity. To participate in the Hydralyze trial and see results risk-free, call 1-800-505-7931. Fragile capillaries around the eye can leak, allowing blood to pool beneath the skin like an ugly bruise. But right now, you can join the thousands of people who have seen their dark circles fade away, watched as bags literally disappeared from view. Participate in the free trial by calling today. If you're serious about getting rid of your dark circles or bags around the eyes, you are eligible to participate and experience a free trial of Hydralyze. For your free trial, call this number today, 1-800-505-7931, 1-800-505-7931.
101.1 WRIF, WRIF HD1 Detroit.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, there's a new administration in Washington, and we've yet to see how a lot of policies work out. We are going to be addressing the new administration, well, and we as the American people will be addressing the policies that have dominated in Washington for the last 8 years. And as the war continues, in fact, is about to be ramped up in Afghanistan, the insurgency at a very low level continues in Iraq, there's going to be more casualties. Men are and some women are going to come home horribly wounded, both physically and mentally. Aaron Glanz has written a book called The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. And you may remember Aaron Glanz from his last appearance on the Peter Werby Show. His book that we talked to him about, pardon me, was How America Lost Iraq. And pardon me, folks, it's winter here in Michigan, as you know. Aaron Glantz is an independent journalist, and his work has appeared in The Nation magazine, The Progressive, The San Francisco Chronicle. He's also been on Democracy Now!, and he's currently a Rosalind Carter Fellow for Mental Health Journalism at the Carter Center. And we welcome Aaron Glantz. He is in San Francisco right now. Welcome back to the Peter Werbe Show, Aaron Glantz.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Peter.
All right, let's oddly enough, take the subtitle first. Washington's battle against America's veterans. Now, that particularly the Bush administration always spoke so highly of the military. When he spoke, he would virtually only speak in front of military, both in Iraq and certainly even here in the United States. How could a Bush administration be battling against America's veterans?
Well, the reason the Bush administration was battling against America's veterans is because they didn't want the American people to realize that there were casualties being sustained on the battlefield in Iraq and Afghanistan. You may remember back at the beginning of this war in Iraq, Donald Rumsfeld said it might be over in a few days, it might be over in a few weeks, but he doubted 6 months.
Sure.
Had he told us that we would be at war in Iraq 6 years later, that 1.8 million American soldiers would serve in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that 300,000 of them would come home with post-traumatic stress disorder, and another 300,000 would come home with traumatic brain injuries, physical brain damage from roadside bombs, then, you know, people might have thought differently about the Iraq war back in 2002 if they had known all of that. And so,
but don't you think that the arrogance that comes with the kind of power, the kind of personality Donald Rumsfeld was, and in fact the whole Iraq adventure was skating in on lies, that he probably believed that the terrible power of shock and awe would end this pretty quickly? Or do you think that in fact he knew that it would be extended?
Well, you know, I was in Iraq myself when we overthrew Saddam Hussein in 3 weeks. I was there in April 2003, and if our only goal was to overthrow the regime of Saddam Hussein and ensure that he had no weapons of mass destruction, then that was a goal that was attainable, in fact, in 3 weeks. It was attained in 3 weeks. However, that was never their intention. Their intention was always to stay for an extended period of time. They had a project to install a particular type of government, and they had this whole neocon vision that was very complicated. And you can be for it or against it, but any thinking person would realize that it would require a tremendous investment of people. And that in a war, when you have that tremendous investment of people, it necessarily involves a lot of soldiers getting killed and a lot of soldiers being wounded. And the Bush administration was never straight with the American people about that. And they weren't straight externally, but they also weren't straight internally. So people came to President Bush, including his VA secretary, Anthony Principi, in the early stages of the war, and they told him, people are coming home wounded. We need to hire more doctors. We need to hire more nurses. We need to hire more claims adjusters. And you know what happened to Anthony Principi? He was fired. And he was replaced by this other guy, Jim Nicholson, who is a real estate developer from Colorado, and whose primary qualification for the job was that he had helped manage the Florida recount for President Bush in the year 2000. And the whole effort at the VA since the beginning of the war has been incredibly politicized by the Bush administration. And the Bush administration, despite what you're talking about, you know, speaking in front of cheering military audiences, once people take off that uniform and become veterans, President Bush did everything he could to keep them from getting benefits. He fought their efforts to get a new GI Bill last year, which passed over his objections. The good news, now we have President Obama. President Obama had a good record in the United States Senate on this issue. He's appointed General Shinseki to head the Department of Veterans Affairs. That's good. General Shinseki is a combat veteran who stood up to Donald Rumsfeld at the beginning of the war. So we have some good signs, but the problems that we face are really tremendous and will take a lot of work by all of us to solve.
Well, I was going to say, end of story then, but not so. Those figures are absolutely staggering when you, that you gave about the wounded, both physically and emotionally. And those are going to be with us for a long time. How do veterans that you spoke to in your book, The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, how do they view President Bush and the policies of the Veterans Administration now? Are they still very positive towards their experience and towards the man that sent them over there?
I think that people, to talk about veterans and their opinions about the Iraq War is like talking about the American people and their opinions of the Iraq War. I mean, you have 1.8 million veterans, and so, of course, nobody has the same opinion. I would say that in my extensive interviewing of Iraq War veterans and my own experience over there in Iraq, the majority opinion that I have found is that most people are not ready to talk ill directly about the merits of the war, but they don't believe it was worth them getting wounded for, or they don't believe it was worth them dying for, or their buddies dying for. They see the tremendous cost that that has been inflicted on the Iraqi people and on our military, and they wonder why. And this wondering why, this wondering what was it all for, makes some of these problems that we're talking about in terms of the wounding of our veterans, like post-traumatic stress disorder, even worse. Because if you have, in war, accidentally killed a pregnant woman at a checkpoint, which happens frequently, unfortunately, in an occupation, but you believe that the mission overall was necessary, it is easier to...
to reconcile.
Hope. So we have some very difficult moral issues that our veterans are wrestling with, and they're wrestling with it in a vacuum because our president, outgoing, had no leadership around it.
Well, you know, the last time we spoke, Aaron Glantz, it was about your book, How America Lost Iraq. The prevailing opinion now is that this is absolutely incorrect, that in fact, we, and I would put that in quotes, we have won in Iraq. There's an election going on today as we record this interview. When you look back at your book, How America Lost Iraq, what's your sense of it now?
Well, the situation in Iraq is more peaceful than it was when I wrote the book in 2005. However, I don't think that we could possibly win the award. I mean, win the war in Iraq. There's no way that we can win the war in Iraq now. What is victory?
What is victory? That's a good question.
Okay. My Iraqi friend, I worked with him as a translator. He had, at the beginning of this war, five brothers. One of his brothers is dead, killed by the insurgents. One of his brothers has disappeared after being kidnapped by God knows who. One of his brothers has spent 3 years in an American-run prison. One of his brothers is so depressed that he can't work because of all the tragedy that has befallen his fellow family members. And finally, the one that I worked as a translator with has had to flee the country and is now living abroad.
Hmm.
So, yes, the violence is down. Nothing new has happened to his family that is negative in the last 6 months. But to me, that's not a victory. You know, what have we done in the last 6 years in Iraq that merits the loss of 5,000 American lives, the disabling of 400,000 American veterans, and the pushing into refugee situation of millions of Iraqi people? Nothing. So I'm glad that the situation in Iraq is improving on the ground, but I would hardly call it a victory for anyone.
The book is The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. My guest is Aaron Glantz, and you can see more of the book at aaronglantz.com. It's AaronGlantz. There'll also be a link on my website, peterwerby.com. On the cover, there's an extraordinarily touching but tragic photo. I wonder if you could describe it and tell us how emblematic that is in terms of the research you did for your book about veterans.
Well, the image that you see on the cover of The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, is of a young veteran named Josh Stein. He's pictured with his newborn son at his home in San Antonio, Texas. He's a double amputee from the war. He lost both of his legs in the war. And he's holding his young child, who's still a baby, in his hands as he lies on the bed, and he's using an American flag as a pillow. It's a very powerful image, and there are over 1,000 amputees amongst the American soldiers who served in this war. But there's actually something else about this photo that I really like, which is that after being wounded and losing both of his legs in combat, Joshua Stein has not given up. He got care at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, and now he's hoping to study psychology so he can give back and counsel other veterans who find themselves in a similar position. And what we need to ask ourselves as a country is whether we are doing our part to support people like this man as they attempt to go forward with their lives. And so far, we're failing in our role.
Well, of course, the veterans and the Veterans Administration and how vets are treated when they go there and what kind of care in general they receive is outside of the radar of the average American unless they're connected up with someone who is a veteran that has suffered damage. That's why I think this book of yours, Aaron Glantz, The War Comes Home, is so important. Let's see, just today, Secretary of Defense Robert M. Gates, this is dated January 28th in New York Times, said that Gates is seeking to improve battlefield trauma care in Afghanistan, and that in Iraq the goal was to have people treated within an hour, and it's 2 hours in Afghanistan, and that one golden hour, as they call it, is often the difference between what people will suffer in the long run. So at least on the battlefield, there seems to be a big commitment to care.
Oh, if you are injured on the battlefield, there is no question that in the first 24 hours after you get hurt, you are going to get excellent care. We have made tremendous advances in battlefield medicine, and almost all of the people who are wounded survive now. Whereas during Vietnam, we lost 57,000 soldiers. In this war, we have not yet lost 5,000 soldiers. And that is not because the war in Iraq is any easier than the war in Vietnam. It is because of the tremendous advances in medicine and body armor that we have made over time.
Which means there's a lot more people. The ratio of killed in action to wounded in action has actually, how am I putting it correctly, increased. There, that a lot of people that previously would have died, say, even a generation ago, now are, in fact, making it through their wounds.
And a lot of the people who are coming home with wounds that cannot be seen. The statistics that I was mentioning at the beginning of this program, 300,000 with post-traumatic stress disorder, 300,000 with traumatic brain injury, physical brain damage. These are things that are not as visible as a double amputation. You know, one of the guys I write about in the book, James Eggemeyer of Stuart, Florida, he came back from Iraq with a back injury, a shoulder injury, and post-traumatic stress disorder that he incurred after loading the bodies of dead Iraqis onto Black Hawk helicopters. He came home to Florida, and he couldn't hold a job. So he filed a disability claim with the VA. And the VA said, prove it. You need to prove to us that you're actually disabled, or else we won't give you your benefit. And during that time that he had to wait 8 months, he lost his house. He lost contact with his son. He had to move into his truck. He was self-medicating because he couldn't get the care that he needed for PTSD, and so he crashed his truck. And it was only because of the charity of other people in the community that he was able to keep from living literally on the street within a year after returning home from Iraq. These are the kinds of stories, these are the kinds of things that face our returning Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans who have wounds that we cannot see.
But Aaron Glantz, is this any different than Vietnam? Because so often the Vietnam veterans were thought of as the walking wounded, and so many of a disproportionate number of Vietnam veterans have wound up homeless and have been involved in crimes of violence. And I mean, some people may be listening to us and saying, yes, we have to give our veterans the best care imaginable, and if the Bush administration didn't do it, let's get President Obama to do it. But war is hell, and whoever goes off to it, even wars that we may all agree are necessary, like World War II, people are going to come home what they used to call shell-shocked, and now it's post-traumatic stress disorder. Is there anything that marks what's happened to our vets here during this era from others?
Well, you're right. War is hell, and that's why it takes a sustained, active amount of leadership on the part of the administration in power and the American people to help the folks who come home. That was missing during Vietnam, and it's missing again this time with the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts. I have a blurb on the front of my book from Max Cleland, the former U.S. senator, also a triple amputee from the Vietnam War, who later on went to serve as head of the Veterans Administration under President Carter. I was in his house in Atlanta, and he said to me, Aaron, it's the same movie. It's not even the remake. It's not even the sequel. I'm seeing the same things play out again that we saw during the Vietnam era. And what is so troubling about that is that we know how that story turns out. We know that the story of our Vietnam veterans turned out with high rates of suicide, with high rates of homelessness, over 200,000 veterans homeless on the streets of this country on any given night, many of them Vietnam veterans. We know how that story ends, but we are early in the story this time with Iraq and Afghanistan. We can write it in a different way. It doesn't have to go the same story. And that's why now is the time for us to seize the moment and insist that President Obama and his VA Secretary General Shinseki show some leadership. We have to engage in this issue. We have to realize that if we don't solve this problem now, it's going to be with us for a very long time.
Aaron Glantz, when you wrote How America Lost Iraq and the time you spent there, I mean, from the beginning, you opposed the invasion, as did I. And when you saw what the shock and awe and the U.S. invasion and occupation has done to Iraq, you were, let me pose it a different way. How did your feelings change towards veterans? I mean, that obviously that it was the military personnel that that perpetrated this policy of the Bush administration. Did you have any change of feelings, of emotion towards the men and women that were the actual soldiers on the ground?
Well, this is how I would put it, Peter. When I was in Iraq, as you mentioned, I was there as an unembedded journalist. So I was primarily interviewing Iraqis about how they were faring under America's bombs. And it was not good. I was constantly interviewing Iraqi people whose brothers or sisters had been carted off to Abu Ghraib and tortured. I was interviewing Iraqi people who were outraged that one of their relatives had been killed, either by accident or on purpose, by U.S. military personnel. And the fact of the matter is that when I was over there, I didn't really have the opportunity to talk to American soldiers because I was unembedded. And anyone who's been in a war zone knows that if you are not embedded with the U.S. military, it's best to stay away from them because they might misinterpret your actions in a way that is not helpful to your safety. And so it wasn't really until I came home to the United States that I began to connect with veterans. And as I did my tour for How America Lost Iraq, I found that the people who came to my events and asked the most incisive questions or made the most incisive comments, and the people who would call in to radio talk shows like this one and share the most interesting stories were always the military veterans. And it's because they were the only ones who experienced the same kind of war I did. They were the only people who knew what Fallujah looked like besides me, who could imagine the street that I was describing. And even if we had a different opinion about the war, at least we were talking about the same war.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I began to report very extensively on the veterans, because I understood that the same difficulties that I was having with my own homecoming experience, the same post-traumatic stress that I was experiencing, my inability to sleep, my inability to relax, my inability to fit in, that the veterans were experiencing the same thing. And I thought it was important that their stories be covered because there were hundreds of thousands of them.
Well, we only have a few minutes left with you, Aaron Glantz, and maybe we ought to talk about what's possible and what veterans need. And I mean, we're talking about expenditure of hundreds of billions. Probably these stimuluses will get into over $1 trillion, and there has to be money for the people that have experienced the worst end of the Bush administration policy. What should we be looking for? What would you like to see President Obama sign?
Well, what the people in Congress are talking about now is a $300 check for disabled veterans. One time. And that's, you know, I'm not against that. But it doesn't really solve any of the problems that we've been talking about. You know, it won't help somebody stabilize their life over the long term to get $300 from the government. We need to have some kind of systematic plan. What I'm looking for from the Obama administration is, first of all, honesty. We started out talking about the Bush administration and their efforts to cover up what was happening to our wounded veterans. The first thing that Obama can do is hold regular press conferences where he talks about the casualties of war and how successful we are in solving this problem. I think that will do a lot to keep the public involved and interested.
And Obama is talking about ramping up the war in Afghanistan, so we're going to be talking about looking at a lot more casualties.
Yes, so what we need from Obama is honesty, number one. We need to know what is he going to do when those casualties come home. Agree or disagree with what he's doing in Afghanistan, we can pretty much be guaranteed that many, many people will come home with post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injuries, and other wounds. So what is his plan? How is he going to deal with this? We need to know. The second thing is that he needs to end the battle. You know, I called the book The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. People have gone to the VA under President Bush, told the VA they were suicidal, been turned away, and then hung themselves. I write about Jeffrey Lucy of Belchertown, Massachusetts. He went to the VA. He told them that he was going to kill himself. He told them how he was going to kill himself. They turned him away, and within a week or two, he had hung himself with a garden hose in his parents' basement.
Right.
Those stories have been far too common under the Bush administration. Under the Obama administration, those kinds of things cannot be tolerated. And we need to hear very clearly from him that that the VA will stop fighting veterans. Maybe we can't solve all the problems right away, but we're going to do our best, and we're not going to be turning people away.
About 60 seconds. What about money? What do we need?
Well, we actually don't need to spend that much money. What we need to do is spend our money more intelligently. Right now, the VA has a huge bureaucracy, and it has a lot of people engaged in trying to root out fraud or make sure veterans are telling the truth. We can give a lot of that money that is currently being given to people who are saying no to veterans. We can give it directly to the veterans. And there's a lot of other things that we can do to spend the money we have in a more intelligent way. And I guess if people want to hear all about that, Peter, we're running out of time, so they'll have to read the book.
Indeed. And you can go to Aaron Glantz's website. It's aaronglantz.com, AaronGlantz.com. It'll also be on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. There's almost 2 million veterans now of the last 8 years. More to come. This is a critical book. In fact, former U.S. Senator and triple amputee and Vietnam War veteran Max Cleland says, a must-read for anyone who wants to make the phrase support the troops more than a slogan. The book is published, by the way, by the University of California Press. Aaron Glantz, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Not my pleasure.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
When was the last time someone offered you a second chance to save thousands of dollars? If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, American Tax Relief is offering you a second chance to eliminate up to 85% of your delinquent taxes. Thousands of honest, hardworking Americans have turned to American Tax Relief for the help they need. Look, your tax problem isn't going to go away. In fact, it's only going to get worse unless you get help. Call 1-800-493-8159. Now you have qualified help in dealing with the IRS. This is the second chance you never had before to save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Get the second chance you deserve and save up to 85% on your delinquent taxes. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation to see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. Call right now for your second chance. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging lime scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, which costs you up to 25% more. That's an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy. With HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system. Guaranteed. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances and save money with HydraCare. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. Lower your energy costs. Visit bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Let's get down to some direct talk from DirecTV. At a time when the cost of almost everything around you is spiraling out of control, DirecTV puts you back in control with this amazing offer. Right now, you can get over 150 digital channels of DirecTV for just $29.99 a month for a full year. For a limited time, ask how to get 3 free months of HBO, Stars, and Showtime. That's 28 of the best premium movie channels free for 3 whole months. Lock in your savings by switching to DirecTV. Call 888-359-5566. Call right now to get over 150 digital channels of DirecTV, just $29.99 a month for a full year. Call 888-359-5566. That's 888-359-5566.
Offer ends 3309, subject to credit approval. $23 bill credit requires rebate and enrollment in auto bill pay program. New DirecTV customers only. Lease and credit card required. Other conditions apply. Call for details.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Those of you who have followed, and how many of you haven't, followed the inauguration of Barack Obama as the 44th President of the United States, knows how much the iconography of Lincoln dominates both everything from the Sunday concert to invoking the memory of the kind of crisis he faced back in the 1860s. So I thought it would be more than appropriate to bring somebody on who has written a lot about the Civil War, and particularly in one of the most crisis years of the Civil War, the American Civil War. The book is called 1864, Lincoln at the Gates of History, and May We Not Be at Similar Gates Today. The author is Charles Braceland Flood, and Charles Braceland Flood is the author of 11 previous books, most recently Grant and Sherman, The Friendship That Won the Civil War. He's a past president of Penn American Center, and he served on the governing bodies of the Authors League and Authors Guild, and he lives with his wife, Catherine, in Richmond, Kentucky, where we are reaching him, and in the middle of an ice storm. Is that not the case?
It is indeed. We have a very sad, we live in a big farm, big old beautiful house with trees 100 years old or more. I hear popping and cracking and snapping every hour here, and the power is out, but as you can tell, we are able to communicate with each other.
Indeed. Now, Some civil wars remain pretty present in the minds of people because there's at least older people alive that that experienced them. So I was thinking of the Spanish Civil War. But the American Civil War was an incredibly long time ago, and yet it is so fascinating to so many of us, both in terms of readers and certainly yourself as a writer, as an historian and a journalist. Why the continuing interest in a period so long ago?
Well, I think one just interesting statistic is that there are at least about 12 million Americans who are direct descendants of the of either Confederate veterans or Union veterans. So there's some built-in interest there, including my own. My great-grandfather was in the 2nd Kansas Cavalry and ended up two horses shot out from under him and ended up in a prison camp in Tyler, Texas, the last year of the war. So there's a lot of direct connection, and then I think it is because it was the great convulsive event, and so many people were involved, and it stretched such a large part of the country. So those factors all play in it. It was just highly dramatic, and I think you get brother against brother, which literally happened. And, you know, it's the stuff of which, had Shakespeare been around, I'm sure he could have gotten 3 or 4 plays out of it.
Well, I should say, I'm surprised it's so few, because I'm a direct descendant of a Union soldier, my great-great-grandfather, my father's side. And, in fact, at the local cemetery, they even have a GAR, Grand Army of the Republic Special Section, for those that are buried. But let's bring it up now. As I look through your book, 1864, Lincoln at the Gates of History, I realized that, and I forgot actually now what speech it was by Lincoln, but he addressed the country as fellow citizens. And in past years, it's been presidents have usually said fellow Americans. Is this? Do you think this is a coincidence that Barack Obama used the same greeting?
No, I think of Barack Obama's not only in fact before, you know, he got to be president, but the parallels are very interesting. If I may go back before that, Lincoln's whole political experience, except for 2 very unimportant years in the Congress long before the war, he had 4 2-year terms in the Illinois legislature, and I think he learned a great deal about politics right there. And it was Tip O'Neill of Massachusetts, the legendary House leader, who said all politics is local, and I think it's a pretty good example that Lincoln learned a lot locally and was able to apply it on a huge scale. And if I may throw something else in, he is not thought of necessarily as this way, but here is a man who brought a patronage to Washington in a way that had never been seen before. And one interesting thing I don't think you're going to find anywhere outside of my book is that he really played the press the way it had never been played before. And he rewarded, once he was in, 40 different either newspaper editors or feature writers or different reporters with political jobs, including at that time the Hawaiian Islands were not an American possession, and he made Abed the commissioner to the Hawaiian Islands, and the man certainly accepted it. So you can imagine if you're a newspaper man in Kansas and somebody says, well, how'd you like to represent us in Hawaii for a couple of years? I don't think he had much trouble filling those jobs.
You say in your book, 1864, Lincoln at the Gates of History, that one of the 2 most pivotal years in the country's history was 1864, the other being 1776. I suspect that probably most Americans would think December 7th, 1941, September 11th, 2001. I mean, it's kind of hard to pick it, but what was so pivotal?
No, that's an excellent question, Peter.
Yeah, go
excellent.
Ahead.
Let me just go to that, because 1776 is obviously important that the nation came into being, but the most severe convulsion this nation has ever faced was 1864, because the war had been going on for 3 years at that time. The North was heartily sick of the war. Lincoln was running for re-election, and the 2 things were inextricably combined: Union lack of military success and his political future. And there was a large body in the North that were called Peace Democrats. And they wanted to see if they couldn't negotiate a separate piece, I mean a piece at that time, which would have left the Confederacy as an independent nation with slavery intact as a very real issue at the time. Now it all seems a long time ago and comes as a surprise to some people, but Lincoln had his plate very, very full, and it was the critical year, I think, by any odds, since 1776 for this nation and for, of course, Lincoln's career.
Well, Charles Braceland Flood, start us off from January 1st, 1864. That, even on the first day, was...
I'd love to read you something from that. It's going to take a little juggling here, but I want to open the book.
Oh, phone in, but yeah. Yeah. Well, while you're doing that, I'll just repeat to people that the book is 1864, Lincoln at the Gates of History, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. There'll be a link to the book at my site, Peter Werbe, Werbe.com. And I bet you our guest has found the section.
You've covered me perfectly while I opened the book and found the exact passage. On January 1st, 1864, 8,000 people, now I'm not reading the text yet, 8,000 people lined up to come in and present their compliments and shake Lincoln's hand. And here is something that I think is really the essential Lincoln. The president had been standing for some time, bowing his acknowledgments to the thronging multitude, when his eye fell upon a couple who had entered unobserved, a wounded soldier and his plainly dressed mother. He made his way to where they stood, and taking each of them by the hand, with a delicacy and cordiality that brought tears to many eyes, he assured them of his interest and welcome. Governors, senators, diplomats passed with merely a nod, but that pale young face he might never see again. To him and to others like him did the nation owe its life.
And a wounded veteran at that time, we were talking with a previous guest who was telling us about how that the wounds are so well taken care of in this era, yet getting wounded in those days was almost a death warrant. For some reason or other, my relative who fought at the Battle of Lookout Mountain, and maybe I got to find out more about the Battle of Chattanooga, he was wounded, I think, a total of two or three times, which is pretty unheard of.
Yeah. Yes, I think you'd find very few Confederate veterans who lived, I mean, Confederate or Union soldiers who were wounded two or three times. I mean, they were lucky to be wounded once and live as far as the sanitary conditions went and so forth. And they were very, very tough days to be soldiers.
Well, tell us, though, you kind of alluded to some of them, what Lincoln was facing, the popularity of the war, his personal popularity. 1864 obviously was an election year.
Yeah, and if you can cover for me very briefly, I'll open to something else because I think it's pretty interesting.
Okay.
It's important that it's understood.
Laughing at myself covering, but here, while you're looking, I will tell you just a small anecdote. When I went to Michigan State University, I took a course on the Civil War, and on the syllabus it was said that office hours, it said four Unionists, and it gave these times, and it said four Confederates by appointment only.
That's a riot. I mean, that really, I presume the professor with a sense of humor. But
yeah,
it's really good. Well, as things went downhill, for example, and it had many dimensions that aren't commonly known now, the North's economy was almost in a state of collapse, if you're looking for any other parallels. And at one point, the dollar was in foreign valuations down to 37 cents. And it was just it was really possible. The Treasury of the United States Treasury, supporting the Union Army, was just about gone. And so anyway, against all this background of people wanting a separate peace and so forth, there were what were called radical Republicans, and they were for a very punitive, assuming the Union War won the war, they were for a very punitive peace. In any case, he was talking to a radical Republican very shortly before, a month or two before the election. And so the man said to Lincoln, well, unless you do something with your army and some other things, you'll be beaten overwhelmingly. And Lincoln took that just as it was given. Quote, you think I don't know I am going to be beaten, he told the radical, but I do, and unless some great change takes place, badly beaten. Now, if I may.
Electorally, yeah.
Yes, sir. Lose, and the man, his own estimate. Now, here is how strongly he felt this. In very late August, he had his cabinet come in at their Tuesday afternoon meeting, and he had on the table a folded over document, and they were not allowed to see what the document was, but on the back, he asked them to endorse, write, sign their names without knowing what it said, this document. And what Lincoln had written and what he could not see, what they could not see, was this statement. This morning, as for some days past, it seems exceedingly likely that this administration will not be reelected. Then it will be my duty to so cooperate with the president-elect as to save the union between the election and the inauguration, as he will have secured his election on such grounds that he cannot possibly save it afterwards. So that's Lincoln's own estimate that he was going to be beaten. Now, what turned it around was that a week later, he got a telegram from Sherman, William Tecumseh Sherman, who had finally struggled through after some defeats and a lot of trouble to Atlanta, and it said, Atlanta is ours and fairly won. So that changed everything, and here was proof that right in the heart of Confederacy now, Atlanta, the second most important city in the Confederacy after Richmond, was in Union hands. And it all began to go Lincoln's way, and he was indeed reelected. And of course, we know that they went on to win the war. But it was really very, very dicey, and I prove that case repeatedly in these pages.
Charles Graceland Flood, we mentioned at the beginning of this about the utilization by President Obama of the images of Lincoln and even the Lincoln Memorial. But I think that George W. Bush has also invoked Bush as well of sticking to his principles, as he would define them, in the face of adversity and unpopularity. And Bush would point to things like the suspension of habeas corpus in the manner that the Bush administration has for prisoners at Guantanamo.
Well, that's an extremely interesting point, and suggests to me you've really read the book, unlike some people who get you on the air. That was a very interesting point, and it came up pretty early in the war, that Lincoln did indeed. Here's this lawyer and dedicated to the Constitution and everything else. But he started talking about war power, quote, war power. There's not one line in the Constitution about war power. And he invoked this concept, which he invented, of wartime emergency powers. And he then began to have people arrested without habeas corpus, which, as we all know, is the citizen's most fundamental civil right and
going
right
back to
protection.
Going back to the Magna Carta, 700
yeah, exactly,
years
no.
before. Yeah.
I mean, went right here. He is trying to preserve democracy in the Union, going right to the suspension of this. 14,000 people were put in prison for supposedly working against the Union. And in one case, which is really interesting, a United States congressman, the only time this ever been done, was arrested by federal authority for urging a crowd to topple King Lincoln off his throne. And that's how far it went. So what I think this shows is how determined Lincoln was to preserve the Union. He was ready even to strike at some of the very basic tenets of the democracy of that Union in order to preserve the Union. And he did the same thing about the Emancipation Proclamation. He didn't invoke it until a certain point in the war. He certainly did want to free the slaves, but he kept saying, of my Kentucky here, saying, if Kentucky goes with the Confederacy, it's all over for us. So he kept holding off with these border states on the subject of actually the abolition of slavery until pretty late in the proceedings. Mm-hmm. So he was a very, very practical, shrewd politician, certainly a great idealist. And if I may just mention something else, he really believed he represented the people and owed them a lot. And every day that he was in Washington, which was the great majority of days of the Civil War, he devoted 3 hours every morning to just walk-ons. I mean, people could arrive at the White House, anybody with anything on their minds, asking usually for favors of one kind or another.
And they were brought in this big, big ante room outside his office. And in the order in which they'd arrived, they would be shown in to see him. And there was something on the order of sometimes 50 people a day, 50 separate little interviews he had per day. So he really meant it when he thought he was the president of the United States. He meant the president of all the people.
Now, my heroes of that period outside of Lincoln are the abolitionists, the Frederick Douglasses, the Sojourner Truth, the mm-hmm. Northern abolitionists. And yet, when we look back at the carnage that that the Civil War created and the human toll, hundreds of thousands of dead on both sides, the South essentially laid waste economically for generations, that the residual of racism that have we finally got over it? I don't think even with everybody on that score. Was it all worth it? I mean, was slavery was intolerable in a modern democratic state, but given the wreckage that it caused, and I mean, some people have argued that slavery would have become uneconomical by the 1890s, and that the Civil War never had to be fought. What's your sense?
Well, I mean, this is certainly a point of view.
Yeah,
I think that. One of the problems there is that, I mean, you have to bring Lincoln's assassination into this thing, into the equation, I think, because there's no question that had he gone on into that second term, he could have had a much easier peace for the South, and probably done a great deal better with the freedmen on behalf of the slaves as well. So when you put that into the equation, with all that post-war storm and strife and all that, nonetheless, I think it was the great test of who we are and who we were. And I think the fact that one of the interesting things to me is that in that 1864 election, 1 million1 million Union soldiers had absentee ballots. And a big question mark as that election approached and was conducted is how are these guys going to vote, because they knew that to vote for the Democrats might easily bring the war to an easier end but not a satisfactory end for the Northern originally stated goals. And yet when they went in, because these guys were being shot at every day, and when they went in there and voted, they voted 3-1 in favor of continuing the war. So that is not a solution to what you pose, but I mean, it's some evidence about this was the time, the real stand-up time in this country.
Maybe we should spend a minute or two talking about some of Lincoln's other policies, because there was other things going on in the nation other than the war.
Yeah, this is, I'm very glad you give me the opportunity to mention that, because he is thought of, and a couple of the really good Lincoln scholars, including one who was nice enough to give my book a very good comment on the jacket, but they genuinely believe that he was a reactive man, you know, that he just dealt with problems as they arose. I see him in a very different light and go to some lengths to explain why. He had been back in Illinois, a pretty prominent lawyer, and his biggest client was the Illinois Central, which was the biggest railroad in the world at that time. And I point that out because he was right on the Illinois frontier. He was right on the cutting edge of westward expansion. He believed in westward expansion. He got government subsidies for the railroads. He pushed in the middle of the war. He did all these things. He had got the railroads going west. He got immigration that brought the Homestead Act into being, and then got money to bring farmers here from European farmers who then settled these western lands. This was all going on at the same time, and it was a remarkable performance. I mean, he did a great deal toward the future of the nation. He believed, you know, his idea is, well, we may not win, but let's have a plan for what to do if we do win. And really quite a remarkable thing. He also was involved in the part of the Homestead Act, the so-called Morrill Act, was the foundation of so many of our great state universities, the land-grant colleges.
Like Michigan State University.
Yes,
yeah.
Sir. And all of this comes from the same man. It wasn't just a man looking south at you know, toward Richmond and saying, when are we ever going to get there?
1864, Lincoln at the Gates of History. We have just a couple of minutes left with Charles Braceland Flood, his book published by Simon & Schuster, just to release. And the book, of course, has got so much detail. We have to get towards the end of 1864. The assassination of Lincoln happened in April of 1865. So as we started off, you read a quote from January 1st. As we entered December and December 31st, where did things stand then? Lincoln had been reelected.
Well, it was, I think everybody finally fell into line. You know, it just, the people who had tried on the Republican side to get a very punitive peace understood that that was not probably going to happen. And so I would, if I may, like to just sort of finish on that day, if
sure.
I may, that the White House, I look ahead to his assassination and so forth, but on that last day, the last fully articulated scene in the book, is detailed scene, is the year we start with a New Year's Day reception. We go to the next one of 1865, and this wounded Lieutenant Gosper is coming into the White House for the same reception. He had a leg shot away in the Battle of Cold Harbor, and he is on his right leg is gone, and he's in uniform, and he's coming in on his own on crutches to shake hands with President Lincoln. And on the way in, he runs into this nurse, and named Ada Smith, and she had been the woman who nursed him when he was brought in with his leg shot off, and just by coincidence they ran into each other, came along in the line into the East Room together. And so Lincoln, as a year before, he's standing way across this very big room. He sees the two of them. He comes walking across, leaves everybody else in that, comes walking across and shakes hands with Gosper and says, God bless you, my boy. And Ada Smith, who wrote about this, said in a voice unforgettable, God bless you, my boy. And so they turn around and go on out. And as they leave, Gosper says to his friend Ada Smith, he says, I'd lose another leg for a man like that.
Wow. That's Lincoln. And unfortunately, we are out of time. The book is 1864, Lincoln at the Gates of History. The author, Charles Braceland Flood, has been my guest on the Peter Werby Show. If you want to link on to that, because I know some of you are driving and stuff like that, just go to Peter Werby, WERBE.com, and there'll be a link there. And I believe that the historian that my guest was talking about is David Herbert McDonald, who said 1864 is a masterly recreation of the last 12 months of Abraham Lincoln's life. This brilliant book recreates the tense drama of the final days of the Civil War and presents a moving portrait of the president in his final hours of triumph and tragedy. Incredible book. Charles Braceland Flood, thanks for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. I wish I could hire you as a PR man.
Okay. Goodbye. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Back to the rock.
We have to do whatever it takes.
Detroit Rock Station. 101 WRIF.
The Riff.
101 WRIF.
And WRIF, HD1 Detroit.
Everything that rocks.